Welcome to the ninth installment of the Polycast Side Series Evergreen. I'm Wouter, Acutus Snijders. The series' ninth season consisted of 27 episodes and a special, including a contest and the first appearance of a non-Civilization developer guest to discuss a non-Civ title. As with the previous Evergreens, Polycast regular co-host Daniel Dan Q Quick selected and ranked 10 topics he feels most retain the relevance years after they were first published. As well, recurring guest co-host Canis Albinus re-listened to the entire season to select the 10 most representative moments for the show alongside an honorable mention. Light 'em up. Number 10, from episode 2-4, when and how to decide one has had enough playtime with a particular civilization title.
The Marshmallow Bear started a discussion on how he thought it was time for him to move on after 1,400 hours of playing Civ 5.
Exactly.
That is the number where you have to stop. If you do not have exactly 1,402 hours, either because you're missing a few or you went over, then you may not stop.
I'm pretty sure the number that you're allowed to move on from is 1,337.
Nope. Nerd.
Yes. And the Marshmallow there does say, and you know, there are other strategy games out there.
What?
Other Threx strategy games out there. I know, heresy.
Fire.
But he does say, Civ 5 bores me now. I could go up and do Beyond Prince, but I don't like the feeling of frustration and careful manipulation of my moves so I can just win.
Wait, what?
That's a choice that you've made.
Yeah.
You are bored because there's nothing more for you to do on Prince. So make the choice. Civ 5 bores you because you're still playing on Prince. But that was a choice you made. I'm not saying that's a blame, but again, that's a choice. If you don't want to go above Prince, you don't want to go into King on Beyond because you feel that it's just not worth the time, then yes, it is time for you to move on. But he also asks in general, are you guys ready to move on? I'm ready to jump ship, to be honest. And I'm thinking, well, you can't jump ship to Civilization VI because there is no Civilization VI. So it's either you stop playing games altogether, yikes, find another game to play with full stop, or play another game, or maybe honestly no games at all for a period of time, and come back.
Yep, it's not that complicated. Like, yep. You find something you enjoy playing, you play that game, and it's nothing and you still want to play games, and you look at stuff until you find something you enjoy playing. It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
But if someone doesn't want to put the effort into getting better at a game, if that's not fun, then the better alternative, if you're bored with it, then is to move on, most likely. That way you're not just getting frustrated all the time.
Yeah. Although he does have a good point, though, is that there's not many or very few at all total conversion mods out there, unlike in Civ 4.
Yeah.
That is a bit of a problem.
Well, there's enough comprehensive mods short of total,
yeah,
including some mods that are just compilations of other mods. Because if you start mixing and mastering certain mods, they may not be compatible.
Yeah.
But if you go for some of the larger ones, short of total conversion one that changes this, that, and the other thing that you know will all work together, then you can go ahead and do that. And unlike Civilization 4, to me, it's easier to be loading and unloading mods into your game as well. I think that also came up in the thread as well. Other than, yes, like you said, he mentioned about total conversion mods. But you don't have to get a total conversion mod to start experiencing modding, because I got the impression that he hadn't tried any mods yet. But if you're looking for total conversion mod and then you reject modding altogether, then to me, maybe you're not that interested in modding to begin with.
Yeah, maybe he just wanted something that totally converted it to still use the same engine but did something different. Maybe that's what he was looking for.
Yep.
May we suggest Civilization Beyond Earth? It uses the same engine.
He heard it here first.
Got fired back.
Number 9 from episode 220. Speaking of Civ titles, implications for when one is tied in part into a non-Civ one.
I could build a spaceship. I mean, starship. I mean, wait. So we now have, you know, we've already had Sid Meier's Railroads, all these other things. Now we have Sid Meier's Spaceships.
Ooh, Starship, actually. But
Starship. Yes, sorry. Starships. Sorry. Channeling and landing from the Lego movie again.
You cannot build.
Scheduled to arrive in early 2015, the turn-based game is coming to PC, Mac, and iPad. And I'm reading from the GameSpot article. And I'm like, oh, So it's coming to iPad, but it's not to come to Android, or at least there's no word about Android?
Yeah, there are other tablets, guys. Thanks a lot.
Android doesn't dominate the market.
That's what I have. I want an Android version so it'll work on my Kindle.
You should not be using a Kindle.
Why?
It's not a tablet. It's a reader.
Oh, sorry. Kindle Fire, if you want me to be technical about it.
Yes,
which is a tablet. Shut up.
Publisher 2K teases that Beyond Earth and Starships will feature cross-connectivity for people who own both games. They won't go into specifics, but says that this integration will, quote-unquote, enhance and expand upon both game experiences, which is, I wouldn't say it's the only reason we're talking about this, but...
It's the only reason we're talking about this.
Except for Sid. No, Sid made it.
Okay.
That's the important.
We don't cover everything Sid on this show just because it's Sid. It just happens to be that everything Sid recently has been Civ related.
Well, except for Air Patrol.
Most of what has been. Once we get more specifics on what that exactly means, the connectivity with Beyond Earth, I think that'll determine in considerable part how much we're going to cover it on this show. But it is space, and Beyond Earth is also space.
Yeah.
And there is a connection mentioned, so it's worth noting.
My prediction is that Starships is just Ace Control or Ace Patrol, whatever it's called.
In space.
In space. I'm pretty sure it's pretty much the same game.
I wouldn't say it's pretty much the same game, because that would be silly.
They did release Ace Patrol and then Ace Patrol Pacific Skies, which were basically the same game.
Yeah, but that's both under the Ace Patrol. I mean, if it was Ace Patrol Stars, then okay, you could probably say that. Otherwise, I mean, for the connection to Beyond Earth, there's two obvious things in the trailer. One, it's post Beyond Earth, and two, it's in the same canon as Beyond Earth, so it's after Beyond Earth, and apparently Purity won.
Yay.
What?
Woo!
Well, if you read some of the comments, it's like, oh, that looks like a Purity ship.
Well, it kind of makes sense, because if you're Harmony, why would you want to leave the planet that you just spent the whole time trying to get in connection with?
Yeah, and if you made contact, why would you...
Maybe
you
want to spread my harmoniousness to other planets.
But also, the important point is that it actually did mention that there were other planets also seeded, and they sucked. Because apparently they lost. Those are the planets where you've lost. If you lost the game. And this is the planet where you won the game. Going off to find out what happened. Like, we got a signal. Oh, no, actually, those are the planets where they put out the contact victory. Except that it actually called you instead. And the Purity is like, dude, we're all still human here.
Dina wants to know, Mackie, do you want to go to space?
Space. Gotta go to space. Space. Space.
I think the question really should be, Mackie, do you want to come back from space?
Probably at some point. There are things on Earth that are not in space.
Chocolate? Coffee?
Mm-hmm. I'd have to take a lot with me. There's not enough room on the spaceship. I'd have to come back for supplies.
Are you sure there's no coffee on that star in the vicinity of Betelguese?
Betelguese. Need to get the...
Jeez.
You just don't know what's going to do that.
Yeah.
Number 8 from episode 231, making lemonade out of lemons is the order in responding to some critical show feedback.
Episode 230 feedback here. Like Dan mentioned about the show notes before we started, it's a little bit on the long side. The majority of my contribution to this was just pointing out that the term itself, exploit, and arguments over definition in general are not very fruitful unless you can come to an agreement on a definition. And that rarely happens in forum arguments, and without it, there's no meaningful distinction between that and just saying a nonsense word, unfortunately.
Between the two threads, both of these on Civilization Fanatic Center, one in the Civ 5 General Discussion Forum and the other in the News Forum, both getting more than 600 views as of this recording. Phil's comments were more on the content, since it was he and Majin that were involved in the particular discussion of the use of the word exploit, and Majin is not on this episode, so I asked Phil to speak to that, kind of in summary. And I took on more of the approach to the conversation, because I know Mackie and myself and our guests really weren't as involved in that particular conversation. But what started it was from Horseshoe Hermie, which was, exploit is not a pejorative term. The Polycast team doesn't need to have a knee-jerk reaction just to someone using that word. The casters called the bias of the post irrational, but attacked a straw man. But it's not their radical error. They single out a guy who plunges into the thick of C++, comes out and describes honestly what he sees, and he gets bashed. It's upsetting. Polycast wants to be a visiting place for the typical sliver, but doesn't try to empathize with one's actual viewpoint. These goals are not mutually satisfying. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah, I feel like that's a little bit over the top relative to what we actually said on the show. Now, I don't remember word for word like our transcript from episode 230, so maybe it's just something I shouldn't. I don't think that merits this response. We did come down on the word mostly because it's being used in a context where at least a good portion of the forum thinks that some of the actions are shady, and it's also being used in, like, in the same paragraph in a context that would mean that playing the game at all is. To Matt and I, that I guess I'm speaking for Matt a little bit here, but that seems somewhat nonsensical because you need something else there. It just it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, my definition of exploit is something that's broken within the game that the devs really need to come and fix in the next update. Anything else is just cheesy tactics.
Yeah, but some people will put cheesy tactics in their definition. What I concluded later on in the thread is that you need something that will differentiate it from anything else, and that actually gets you to change your actions regarding those versus something else for the term to be useful. But it's true that Delner actually did provide quite a bit of useful data in terms of AI. Like, I did not know all of its limitations with regard to move and shoot, for example, where it will not move towards something in the fog and then fire on you. That's, if anything, that just makes me more capable of abusing its inadequacies, but I do appreciate it.
Well, AI needs so much improvement because it's on every game, not just Civ. I mean, it's very difficult for it to play to a human level. It's either pretty weak or annoyingly too good.
Yeah, unless you just make it a game of how quickly you can react to something, AI is not going to be able to keep up with a human. And that's part of that is computing time, honestly. I don't know if you want, like, 7-hour turn times. It would certainly improve the AI. Don't know how much, but it would improve it. And part of that's just the marginal increase you get in how, quote-unquote, good an AI is versus the amount of time the developers spend on it. And there are some realistic limitations there.
There is a balance, yes.
Yeah, and to a degree that also impacts your design, not of the AI, but of the game and the game's rules. If you intend for the game to have a heavy single-player component or a multiplayer component where the AI is still a big factor, then some of your mechanics that you put in the first place, if they're not workable in the context of an AI, then they probably shouldn't be used. And I think that's something a lot of developers lose sight of, and it really costs for Axis early in Civ 5. The AI was not on a level to handle the changes.
That's very true.
It got much better over time, but yeah, you're right. There's a balance on how much time you put into making the AI strong, and there's also a balance in terms of how you design your mechanics such that an AI can handle them, or if you just abandon that and AI entirely and make it only multiplayer. Those are not necessarily easy choices for a development team.
No, you definitely need a game with a strong single-player content. Otherwise, you have to just go sort of like the Doha 2 route and be completely multiplayer.
Yeah, I mean, but you can do that. You can make a Dota 2 or a Counter-Strike or whatever, if that's what you're going for. And in that case, it doesn't make much sense to put a lot of time into the AI, because what you're trying to do is make your multiplayer experience as good as possible.
Yes,
they make
definitely bots,
but they don't make, like, great bots. And I would argue that it's not too important, because mostly when you see people playing against those bots, it's people who are learning.
Yeah.
Horseshoe's comment about us bashing Delnar. I said, with respect, I disagree that Delnar was bashed. A position was taken that countered his view, and that counter was articulated. I can understand someone not favoring the pointedness of the articulation at times, though again, it was an argument that was being challenged, not of the author themselves. If the degree of that pointedness came across so as to cause offense, no, that was not the intention. And in fact, Delnar said, "You need not protect me, Horseshoe. I was not offended by their approach to quote-unquote exploits, though I do suppose I would have preferred they discuss another post, seeing as there's not much they really added that is not already said in the thread." And my response to that was twofold. First off, I said, I'm glad that you didn't feel offended. But moreover, I said, often points that are made on our show on topics attached to forum threads are those that have already come up in the thread. And when they do, we try to articulate them, we try to expand on them to, you know, minimize, if not outright remove, assumptions, because a listener's familiarity with the topic may just be what we're saying. They may already have experience with it. They may not go and read the forum thread. So say we're not going to bring up what's already in the forum thread that we feel is relevant, because sometimes threads go off topic. Not to say that we don't. But in this case, I said the conversation in question was a response to a post of yours, Delnar, rather than a separate thread itself. So if the discussion had been more specific and extensive to your post, more would surely have been explored, because what this was, in response to a thread about higher level difficulty play in Civ 5, where people were going over some interesting statistics about the game's players, and Delnar's comment about exploits had come up as a reason why a lot of people do not want to play on the higher difficulty levels, in particular Immortal and Deity. Phil, you continued on the conversation, and it's kind of one of those cases where, in addition to not wanting to monologue, we encourage people to look at this thread. Not that we don't encourage people to read the threads that we discuss on the show,
yeah.
But there is a lot of information here, and sometimes this kind of conversation works better in a printed format as opposed to a verbal format. Though I will briefly jump to the second thread, which was the news topic. Legalized Freedom had said, enjoyed the show as always. However, the Beyond Earth negativity is wearing on me. I'd be the first to admit the game's flaws, but in my opinion, it's still a great game, and obviously will get better as mechanics and content are added. I see far too much forum think as it is, and enjoy Polycast to get some rational arguments for and against strategies, mechanics, etc. Now I hear the game being insulted on this show, and I can't see how that adds to the discussion. The guest, developer, seemed to be trying to bring the conversation around, and his input was a nice break, albeit a bit too positive times. I'm not suggesting a sugar-coated show, but insults are too much, and I can count on Phil for a rational response. Which, found a nice place in Phil's heart.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Legalized Freedom had concluded by saying, thanks for the effort of producing this show. So while it obviously took some disagreement with what he said, it was expressed constructively. Not to say that Delnar was not doing that in the previous thread, or even Horseshoe, but had a little bit more edge, perhaps. I had said in response to Legalized Freedom's are being really negative about it and insulting the game. See, the big word from Horseshoe was that we were bashing Delnar, and now from Legalized Freedom, it's that we were insulting Beyond Earth. And my response to that was, in the past, we as a regular panel and a number of guests have discussed our concerns about Civilization Beyond Earth, which included mechanics, strategies, and the like. Here, concerns are raised about what we know about the Rising Tide expansion pack, and that was the focus, but so too were hopes and wonderings. They tie back to parts of what we said in the past about Beyond Earth, and areas of concern tend to get more discussion points than hopes or even wonderings. And yes, this was about a separate topic on the last episode, which was about the announcement of the Rising Tide expansion for Civilization Beyond Earth, or Civbert. I said that just for some people that don't like
Civbert.
That. I could not resist.
I like it.
And of course, the next statement has to be Civ Ernie will be the second expansion factor for Beyond Earth. I called that weeks ago.
Yeah.
That said, the segment of the show you're referring to, and this is again to Legalized Freedom, it was a continuation for and included on episode 229 of the show. So we had a balance of conversation about Rising Tide that spread across the two episodes as opposed to one. And I said to Legalized Freedom, without a doubt, there was more concern as opposed to hope or wonderings in the portion that was included on episode 230. So I mentioned before the show that after episode 229, and we talked about this on episode 230, which was essentially, where's the teeth? Where is the criticism and concern about what we know about Rising Tide? And it's like, well, you know, we had Derek Paxton, Galactic Civilizations 3 developer, on the show. And so in editing, I prioritized that for the hour's worth. But I said that, you know, we would include the second part in the subsequent episode. And given timing and more information about Rising Tide coming about through E3, I decided there needed to be a pretty quick turnaround so that we would have that balance from one episode to the other. And now, of course, we get a response. You guys are awfully negative about this. Where's the balance?
Yeah.
So I here said, I can understand someone not favoring the pointedness of our articulation at times about Beyond Earth. I said, though personally, I don't believe any insults were dealt. But if that degree of pointedness came across as insulting, again, that was not the intention. And I thanked him for listening and for the feedback that he provided. And although I didn't include this in either of the threads, swear alert, if people did not give a shit about what we were saying, then they wouldn't bother to respond.
Good point.
And yes, it's true that we're more likely to get negative feedback just because of the emotions that are often tied to that. People are more likely to complain than they are to compliment. But at the same time, if it was just, well, they're just rehashing the same thing over and over, I've already done that on the forums. I've already seen that on the forums. They're not really adding anything to the conversation. We don't care about the show or what's being said on the show. Then they wouldn't respond. And so the fact that a number of people took the time to express their concerns, and then between my response and Phil's response, extending that conversation beyond what was covered on the show, that's what we really like to see, is the audience interaction. Gives us a sense of what our audience thinks we're doing right, maybe not doing so right, but it also gives us a chance to extend on what we may or may not have said on the episode. And we would rather people call us out constructively rather than just mumble, grumble, mumble, and not listen to the show anymore.
Absolutely.
Because that's the point, is to not just reflect dialogue, but also to extend it.
I do wish we had Majin around, though, because like, he's the one that came down the hardest on it. I think we have some degree of consensus on the panel that there are certain things in the game that need work. But as someone who spent a lot of time in Civ 4 and then felt a little bit roughed up by the attempted transition to Civ 5 because a lot of its subsystems were either not developed or didn't work, I can see where he's coming from, certainly.
Legalized Freedom had further said, "What I mean by insult is implying the game is dead or is not a good game. That may be some folks' opinion, but I have come to expect optimism alongside the understandable cynicism from Polycast. I generally find Polycast to be above that kind of name-calling. Can't we go every other place on the internet to find that?" That was my observation. I first thought, interesting characterization of the show, although not the first time we have heard that. Appreciated the clarification, I said. All of us on the panel spoke of or to disappointment with Civilization Beyond Earth between this, so between episodes 229 and episodes 230. Not all of the panelists came to the conclusion that Beyond Earth is dead or not a good game as a result of that disappointment, though. And then I said, speaking for myself at least, I know I came across as having hope for the Rising Tide expansion to address parts of Beyond Earth's falterings, while also looking to temper some of the pre-expansion release criticism within the Civ community. Ultimately, if we thought it was a dead or not a good game, given what we'd already said about Beyond Earth, if we didn't feel there was something about Rising Tide beyond the fact that it was announced, and then we move on to another topic, we still wouldn't be talking about this game.
Well, I'll quite happily fill Majin's shoes. Firaxis are going to be very lucky if they think I'm paying more money for Beyond Earth. I wish them absolutely the best of luck, and I hope it's fantastic, but yeah,
you know,
I'm not.
I do hope that it's going to be like we had with Civ 5, where as the expansions came out, things got better in the game. It's just I played it for a few months, and I got frustrated with it, and it, for me at least, it seemed repetitive. And it's not that there's not the bones of a good game there. That's never what we're saying.
I was so excited.
Engine. And also, one of the things lost in Civ 5 is it isn't just the new features such as the Rising Tide for Beyond Earth or Gods and Kings in Brave New World for Civ 5 that made Civ 5 play better. The patches, and the devil's in the detail of the patches, because you can go the wrong way with this. Europa Universalis has gone the wrong way with this a few times. But those patch changes, even if they're subtle, add up. And sometimes they're not so subtle impacts on gameplay. It's something you don't think about now, but when you had the quote-unquote flanking bonus in vanilla, and you could stack that up to like plus 50% combat strength, how that trivialized the units, unit strength, unless you were like eras in front. It's easy to forget that that was ever a part of the game now, because it's been so long since that has been a part of the game. But that was a patch note change. That didn't change just because of an expansion release. And there's a lot of things like that over time that gradually made Civ 5 play a little better. And certainly some people still don't like one unit per tile. Some people still don't like the four cities. It's reasonable if you don't like those things, fine. But regardless, the patches themselves changed a lot, and what we see in Rising Tide is not necessarily what's going to make the game much better, much worse when it comes time to play it. And I'm not saying that it's guaranteed going to get better either. I mean, games can be damaged quite a bit by changes in their patches that attempt to fix one thing and make things worse.
Well, they're being quite forward-thinking, aren't they? I mean, they're putting the water game in with, obviously, hence the name Rising Tide. And if you watch the videos that have come out, all the keywords I'm hearing are artwork, leaders. I'm not hearing gameplay. I'm not hearing balance.
That's not unusual, though, because let's be honest, when you look at any game and they're talking about how much they talk about specific balance changes or specific aspects of gameplay, they'll talk about how good the gameplay is or maybe say, you know, it's turn-based and this or that, but it's pretty rare to see pre-discussions unless you're like in a League of Legends forum on a Riot post or something to see actual discussion about specific balance points and what the reasoning behind it is.
Yeah, what they're talking about right now with Rising Tide are they want talking points for general gaming media.
Yeah.
And that's also selling points, right? It's also marketing. What we're interested in, those kind of nuts and bolts, that'll come out more through forum discussions, screenshot dissections, and once the game is actually released, I'm certain that there will be conversations from Firaxis and 2K or, you know, looking for questions from members of the community to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty.
Number 7, from episode 223, when the presence of uniques in the Civilization series is challenged, a challenge is issued back.
I'm not even going to try the username. That's Al. I don't know. Maybe you can tell us.
Now, Calcodem? Looks like that.
Okay. Phil said it. He's asking, are you really in favor of uniques? He says he sees not a single point to uniques. The unique units, I believe, is what's going on here. Wasn't clear at first. And he's going down the list. First, what do you want them? It's like diversity and replayability in favor. And why he wants them, he doesn't like the imbalance. He thinks you would get a lot more civilizations that way. I don't know. They still have to do art assets and all that kind of things where I don't know that would give you more civilizations. We want you to be able to earn your advantages. And replayability is on both lists here. I don't get that one. But also gameplay choices. I think you want something more like you start a little more generic and then specialize into your civilization as opposed to starting as your civ.
Isn't that what Beyond Earth tried to do?
Yeah.
Yeah, it just sounds to me like he's asking for a different game.
I can't really make sense of a lot of it. It's sort of jumbled up, but it kind of looks like he's saying that by removing uniques, civilizations will be more unique and more replayable, which doesn't really make sense.
Right. Well, I think what he's getting at is you can replay as the same civilization and do different things and unlock different units, and then that one civilization is replayable. But then I think the common counter to that would be, but then the whole game isn't as replayable because you basically just have one civilization that you just customize however you like, and it doesn't matter which one you pick because none of them have anything that's unique to them.
What do you want to do? Start out with civilization group or something? Like a proto-Roman type of thing, but you could also split off into other things from that or something.
Maybe he was thinking something along the lines of making up unique units as you go, perhaps, like with the research. And there's a number of things you could do with it, but I don't see what's necessarily wrong about the unique units other than that some of them just aren't exciting and unique abilities.
One of the things that I definitely think that I'd like to see in future games is to have the actually pros and cons of using the uniques. Have some uniques that maybe do something special, but they're like weaker overall, but they're really good at doing this one thing. But then leave the default unit available. So a common example would be like taking the old German Landsknecht back when that was a unique unit. It could have been like cheaper and weaker than a regular pikeman, but you could still have the regular pikeman available. So if you needed to just pump out a bunch of cheap units real quick to like defend yourself, you had that unique opportunity. But if you actually needed the stronger pikeman, then you could do that. Another example would be like the Korean. What is it called? Where it's stronger at killing units, but weaker at killing cities. But you should still have access to the regular in case you still want the city siege capability. So you don't end up in the situations where, again, using Korea as example, their caravel replacement can't cross oceans. They are handicapped. So it would be nice for them to be able to build regular caravels, even if you make them like more expensive or something like that.
There's a number of units that have that little bit of a thing where you might want the original as a slingers that you get from the Inca. If you were trying to use those as an early assault or something like you would with normally with archers, but they get attacked, they push back a tile. Oops, I'm out of city range.
Yes, but like I think that adds a little bit of flavor and uniqueness to controlling the nations in the first place. From a replayability standpoint, I don't see what removing unit types would really help with. I really don't. Yeah, okay, some of them could be better. Fine. Then go ahead, make them better. But don't think a global removing of uniques is going to do much for the title.
And in regards to that, Mackie brought up Europa Universalis before. That actually reminds me of something. A friend of mine before gifted me a copy of Crusader Kings, and I just couldn't really get into it the same way that I could at Civ, because none of the factions or civs felt like the factions or civs. They just didn't feel unique, much as I was playing as faction A or faction B.
Some of the things you can do in that are probably not family-friendly to discuss on this show, actually. But,
especially Crusader Kings.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking of Crusader Kings specifically and saying this, because it's all these games, CK2, EU4, and Civ 5, Beyond Earth. Civ 5 and Beyond Earth are probably the closest to each other out of those four I just mentioned. But, man, like, Yeah, you're basically a dynasty in CK2 rather than a nation.
On kind of the same train of thought, one of my favorite things about Civilization, and I know a lot of people in the Civilization fan base feel the same way, is I like the historical context and the educational opportunities that Civ provides. I think by taking away the uniques, you don't get that same gameplay feel of what made these civilizations special in history. I mean, sure, you could read the Civilopedia entry, but it's so much more informative to actually be able to experience what made them unique. And if you just have a bunch of just generic things where you just tech up to some unit, then you're not learning about what made that civilization unique. You're just kind of in this amorphous gray zone. You're kind of getting some vague ideas about, oh, there was this historical thing called the Legion, but I don't really understand its context or place in history because I don't know who built it or what they did with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, man. Thumbs up.
I agree.
Yeah, you take out the uniques, and how would it not be fun to be Spain? You have tercios and conquistadors, and, oh, hey, look, here's another continent with some less civilized people. Guess what?
Right. I mean, at that point, you're not picking a civilization. You're just picking a flag, colored flag. What is the point of having the civilizations? At that point, you might as well just have a single customizable civilization like some other games. But that's not Civilization. Sid Meier's Civilization has this historical grounding, and I think that if you take away the uniques, you start to lose that.
Well, it would be interesting to see a designer. That'd be kind of cool, actually. Like as DLC or something, you just make anything you want.
Oh, that would be
Sid
so
designer. Well, yeah, but you would have like points to spend, and everything would be valued at points. So you could overpower a little bit. You could probably get a good synergy of things going together that maybe they wouldn't have thought of in the base game, but I don't know that you could really OP it.
I saw them a while ago, a chain of mods on the Steam Workshop by this guy named Blue Blue. Basically what he does is takes out all the Civ's uniques and makes them just standard units that you tech up to with any civilization. So if you want to play a game without uniques, you got the Workshop.
Right, so there's his proof of concept. The author of this post should play that and see what he thinks about it.
Number 6 from episode 226, a step-by-step guide to Civ multiplayer gets a step-by-step response.
How to kill everyone.
In multiplayer, killer. Let us clarify.
Serial killer wins.
Killer robots.
From T.S. Chucky. Most multiplayer games end with one guy cleaning up the map. To be this guy requires a strong empire, and it requires not to be killed before your time comes. Here are some guidelines on how to set up your empire
really?
And how to survive.
Really? And to be the guy who wins, you have to not get killed?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
I missed that part. Glad you mentioned it.
Yeah, wait, dude.
And yes, if you want to troll this quote, you could say, guy, sexist.
Yeah.
People die when they are killed.
Maybe needs a disclaimer, must be alive to accomplish.
Yeah, pretty much.
And up front, Deadpool is like, it makes me sad that it seems domination is the major victory type for multiplayer. It is my least favorite way to play single player. Okay, well, number one, if it's your least favorite way to play in single player, that doesn't necessarily mean it will end up being your least favorite way to play in multiplayer. And if you really hate it that much, you could just have it be that no one declares war on anybody. I mean, we don't have an always peace option like we had in Civilization 4, but find a group of people that want to win by other means.
Well, show of hands, who used that option in Civ 4, by the way?
On purpose.
Yes, on purpose.
Are we showing hands?
Not Mitch clicks.
I don't think we see that through the internet.
Yeah, not, well, we can, yeah. But...
Yeah, I don't see any hands, lol.
No.
I have proven my point somehow.
There are lots of things we don't want to see through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
that way. You don't know that for sure. That's just confirmation bias, Dan.
Person is like, on turn zero, the first thing you do is click victory progress to see all the Civs in the game. Make a mental note about the special military units you may face and the tech at which they become available. I always find that kind of lulzy. Find out what Civs are in the game. Go to victory progress. But, hey, yeah, sure. A low score indicates that there are water tiles in their capital. This is crucial knowledge, especially when you are coastal. Once everyone has settled, do not care about this ranking anymore. Points are meaningless. Demographics is what counts.
I don't know. Points, actually, they are meaningless generally, but if somebody has super high points versus you, they probably have a bigger empire than you. So it's not entirely meaningless.
Although you can probably glean that data pretty easily from the demographics or looking at the map also.
You can just go to diplomacy and look at their score and how it's broken down.
Yeah.
Check the demographics each turn and check the tech tree regularly to know who is doing what. I don't know about every turn. Also check the golden resources the other guys have. Check the military score. Watch it religiously. Yeah, I mean, that gives you some indication, although you don't necessarily know what the composition is, where the military units are relative to their land and your land.
It's still good advice, because if someone's military score spikes across a short period of time, there's some writing on the wall there. So it's better to do that than not do it.
Yes. Build two scouts first. Find spots to settle and find out if they are contested. Settle the contested spots first to find your land. When settling contested spots, put an emphasis on defendability. No, really.
Build on a hill.
More so than normal.
Yes.
It is often the best play to sacrifice a river or a mountain in order to create a city that will be extremely hard to attack. I don't know why you'd have to sacrifice a mountain, because a mountain would very much help to make it a little more difficult.
Back it up into the mountains where there's only two tiles to attack from right next to the city. There you go.
Well,
there you go. Really hard to attack, except that it might also not be able to produce. And probably get starved to death if you fill it with units.
There's a balance point there, to be sure.
Yeah.
Find out where the others are. I would have moved that farther up.
Probably quickly a little higher up on the list.
Well, it's implied with which spots are contested, though. Like, you're not going to know that unless you know where the others are.
Gotta build those scouts.
The gist is okay. Let's not go too far into the construct of the writing.
Yeah.
This isn't a paper for grading.
It can be. Ooh, I like this thought.
Yeah, okay. I know your nature will make you evaluate that a little bit extra, but yeah. And I agree, it kind of makes it seem silly to me, too. I mean, that line should have probably been a paragraph up, but that's fine, that's fine. Let's continue.
So at this point, it may turn out that you have to kill someone near you in order to not let them have camels, keshiks, or whatever. This is especially true when you find a capital near you on flat land that is easily accessible. Oh, look, that flat land near you, easily accessible enemy city, regardless of when you're going to get your unique unit, that makes it an instant target, absolutely. Early war will always handicap you. It will delay the development of your empire.
Unless you take out all your opponents.
So you need a good reason to get at someone's throat. Like, referring to your previous paragraph, you find a capital near you that's easily accessible on flat land.
Just box them in right away.
Basically, if your neighbor didn't read this to say, go land on defensible territory, go kill them. Because they didn't need this.
Although it's true, like, if you commit to an early war, you darn well better be successful in your early war.
Well, that's the
case. Otherwise, you're hosed.
That's it.
But that's the reality. If you go to war and you do not take something, or at least sufficiently amount equal to what you put into trying to go to war to keep you up and running, then yes, that was a bad choice, and you will probably die. But if you can take out a bunch of stuff, like say I go Assyria, build out six of the siege towers, and take down five or six cities with those in decent locations, then I just built an empire with much less tech.
And there's also a balance in there in terms of even through the early war, even if you are successful and you end up taking one or more cities of that civ, if it's too prolonged, then just like the civilization that you eventually get rid of, you spent all that time and investment and resources into that war, then yes, you won that war. Unless that's the last civ, there's probably somebody else watching what's going on, and now you're in a weakened state because of that prolonged early war.
Yeah.
So sometimes it can be a hollow victory, too. You want to be able to take the city, and you want to be able to take the city in a reasonable amount of time. Now, whatever that reasonable timeout it is depends on the game speed. It depends on what particular area you're in, where other civs are. But, yeah, absolute statements are absolutely problematic. Early war will not always handicap you, but a prolonged early war will handicap you.
Yep.
Just how much will it handicap you? Will you be able to recover? That's key.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
T.S. Chucky says, further, if you only have room for three crappy cities, your land is not winnable. Because he's also saying the other thing that you need to do here is to get winnable land. There is a nice rule of thumb. If after labs, that's research labs, if after research labs with the first three rationalism tenets, you make 1,000 beakers or more, your land was winnable. If you cannot come close to 1,000 beakers, your land wasn't good enough, and you should have done something about this earlier. To get to 1,000 beakers requires four good cities. Why is this a nice rule of thumb?
1,000 beakers is useful to have, but...
If everybody else also has 1,000 beakers.
Are you an advanced start? Like,
you need a better earlier gauge to evaluate your progress.
I gotta point out, if you wait two labs at the end of the game to decide whether or not...
Your land was good enough or not,
That's a little late to decide that. Especially if you got conquered along the way.
If you got conquered, your land probably wasn't good enough.
Yeah. Or you were.
Yeah.
That's beside the point. It's about the land.
You did not get winnable land. It does not matter if that was because your land was not good enough or because you weren't, but you did not get winnable land if you are dead.
I know in the multiplayer games that crazy high population capital is usually how they reach this 1,000-beaker mark. That's why they don't want to expand too much because of the tech costs and happiness increase once they have that super giant place.
Yeah, well, it's also tradition better than liberty, et cetera, even in single player.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 4-city tall is pretty much the dominant strategy. You can use other stuff, but reality is not so much.
He cites that the two crucial military units accessible to everyone are frigates and artillery.
Yeah.
You can get to them.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's,
and if the iron isn't on the other side of the map.
I'm more agreeing with this than the previous comment about labs and rationalism tenets. Frigates are a huge factor once your empire is not the only coastal one. And we will say, assuming, of course, that it's a map that has coast. Or, or where the coast is actually an issue. Scout the coast, see you as a cap that could be shot from a lot of water tiles. Then you could go for the kill or for diplomacy.
Or?
Diplomacy?
I think instead of diplomacy might be extortion.
Or lying.
Well, he then explains, since Russian frigates would delay your tech, you could also talk to the other coastal guys. Here's what this guy's again. Okay, huh.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to the other coastal guys and agree not to frigate rush each other.
Good.
Wait, what?
Gentlemen's agreement, let's not rush.
Well,
right.
How many times have people said that then killed each other?
Trust is an excellent quality for other people to have in MP games. Diplomacy is to factor.
Yeah, for other people.
Absolutely. You want other people to trust you,
yeah,
so you win.
For other people to have, see?
Well,
yeah, that's the point of diplomacy, is to instill trust in others.
Just label everyone a backstabber, and you'll be perfectly fine with your trust issues.
Yeah.
And you're a backstabber, and you're a backstabber, and you're a backstabber. You're
but
all backstabbers.
You can make them think that you're not a backstabber, in addition to knowing that they probably will be. That's perfect.
And I have a knife for you, and a knife for you.
I think you mean I have a nuke for you, and I have a nuke for you.
I don't know. I read that and I thought, did you start playing a single player game suddenly? I just diplomacy and MP. And domination. Okay, I can see it in certain situations, but this is supposed to be a quick guide.
No, Dan, if you want to frigate rush somebody, you don't want them also building frigates. It's perfect.
Yeah,
there's diplomacy there.
To do it.
Yeah.
Artillery is a game-breaking unit, also in the sense it can break you. Mm. Okay, artillery, yes, but I'm thinking more a little earlier in the game. You get yourself cannons before other people do.
If cannons, you can.
Yeah, I'll be a little more concerned about that, just in terms of the chronology.
Yeah, but the thing is, in multiplayer, people will actually pull out a horse unit to go behind the lines to kill the cannons, or at least are more likely to not sit there and let you cannon spam them. And, as well, you're also likely to have your own cannons, so it'll be cannon versus cannon. There won't be a front line, which means defender wins.
And with ranged cavalry units like the Keshiks or the Camel Archers being highly sought after in multiplayer,
yep.
The cannons are even more vulnerable.
God, trying to defend cannons from Keshiks doesn't sound fun.
But the whole artillery thing, it's that whole three range, I boom you from huge distance.
And over terrain.
Yeah, so it becomes way less of a problem. But the funny thing is, his logic here is actually a little goofy.
Yeah, I agree.
So he says, if you're in a game, don't go artillery after universities because you have to kill everybody. Because if you don't, you're going to be behind in tech. Okay, that makes sense because others will go to public schools. Okay. The problem is, anybody who goes to public schools didn't go to cannons.
I went to public school as a child.
Yeah, you didn't get a free cannon, did you?
No, I didn't.
No, they didn't give me a free cannon either. I would have loved to have a free cannon.
But
I'm not sure how I could have moved it as a kid. It's pretty heavy, but it would have been awesome.
So if somebody goes heavy on the military side against a lot of people who just teched, those people who teched eventually have to go back to the military side, or they have to hope that they can jump into infantry really, really quickly, which means that even if you go university to cannons plus gunpowder, you're still going to out-unit the people who went to public schools directly.
Yeah.
But the worst part about the logic, not just that, maybe he includes people who go to gunpowder and cannons first and then go to public schools rather than continue up to artillery. But the worst part of the logic is the next one.
Yeah.
In a game with noobish players, on the other hand, you will regularly encounter opponents who take this path. So noobs go to artillery, but wait, there's more. So once again, be aware of what's going on around you. Check the tech tree. That makes sense. If your neighbors go artillery, you are forced to dig deep into the tech tree as well. So don't go to artillery because experienced players will put you hopelessly behind in tech and they will not have actual weapons to defend against you. But a noob who goes artillery makes you change your tech path.
Or you die.
But yeah. Experienced player who goes to artillery does not make you change your tech path.
I don't know what to say to that.
There's something weird in there.
High five.
Or is this an extension of his quote-unquote diplomacy where he goes artillery while convincing everyone else to go public schools? Because that's about the only thing I could see that makes sense. The logic in the last two paragraphs just doesn't. I'm sorry. If artillery is so strong that going it forces good players to also go artillery to survive, then you might as well go artillery and kill anybody who doesn't go artillery.
Yes.
Thanks for your public schools.
Yeah.
Now I have tech.
They're useful.
That is the point of going to a military unit that is more powerful than what is around, to use it to get their stuff, because they went peaceful and you didn't.
Yeah.
Now, granted, if you go to artillery and you can't use it to take somebody else's stuff because they weren't dumb, then you went to artillery and lost the opportunity to use it, and therefore you will be behind in tech.
What a unit like artillery, they probably went artillery too, if they're surviving that easily. That or they're like across water. I mean, okay, if you're playing an islands game or something,
well,
then maybe you don't want to rush artillery, but I mean, come on.
That would be
that should be obvious, but I mean, whatever.
You could go bombers.
Yeah.
But the thing about air units, you have to go to biology and to flight. And once you get those, there's your problem.
Yeah, they destroy artillery with these. You need anti-aircraft guns or your own planes.
Yeah, and if you went to artillery and somebody went to flight with biology, of course, they actually need that. Then, and only then, did going artillery be a really, really, really bad plan.
That's if you don't also manage to deny them the resources they need to build those units.
Well, you'd have to have gone to biology to find out where the oil was.
If you're going artillery, you should already have a huge cannon force and gold piled to get the most out of the unit.
Yeah.
Number 10 from episode 236.
But yeah, I mean, anytime you come up with a top 10, there will always be arguments over, is that really?
No, there won't be.
Or is there something else that should be a top 10?
Or there will always be a Dan posting his top 10s. Oh my gosh.
Somebody said top 10. Let's talk about it.
Exactly.
Number 9 from episode 225.
Beware of trollish behavior for an American player as they might use their tile discount to buy tiles. Yeah, that's just horrible gameplay. I've seen the AI do that. So
yes.
Not just humans. But yes, they might. Don't send a settler through a gap in America's borders. Why? Because they didn't want you there anyways. You shouldn't be trying to sneak settlers past another player through their territory.
Oh, players are...
Yeah, there'll be a lot of ishing. Or just open-ended. No more ish.
Declare war!
Thanks for the free worker.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless you're using that as a distraction, although I think there are other units that are... you can use as a distraction.
A settler. Okay. Here you
go. Look at my settler!
You will spend one attack on one turn to deal with this. It's all part of my plan. So is losing all my cities to you.
Number 8 from episode 227.
Well, one of my favorites is to pull a rough hive. It's a guilty pleasure. Well, it's a pleasure. I don't know about the guilty part.
All right, explain for everyone, you know you want to, what pulling a rough hive is.
Okay, so pulling a rough hive means that somewhere near the end of the game, you have to declare war on Dan Q and only Dan Q specifically, without fail.
You nuke him?
Optional. The important part is to declare war on him. What you do after that is up to you, and, you know, variety is the spice of life. So you can do any number of things after declaring war on Dan. But you have to declare war on Dan. End of every game. No exceptions. To do that is to pull a rough high.
Why is that a rough high?
The previous player. Yeah.
Number 7 from episode 240.
We are now going to go to another returning guest co-host, first on in Season 7, Season 8, but also on Season 9, it is someone who is very keen to come onto the show and was actually on the call before we started the live stream. It is Fuzzy Fractal 42. Andrew, hello.
Hello, how are you guys doing?
How you doing?
I'm doing
I knew someone was going to do that.
How you doing?
Oh, I'm sorry. I did not give the proper hello and salutation to Fuzzy.
Hello!
Almost missed an opportunity there.
Number 6 from episode 242.
Well, I know what my religion will be in the next Turncast.
Denouncing Dan.
Yeah, whatever Civ Dan rolls, denouncing that.
Thanks, Maggie.
Or just denounce Condorism. There
you go. Oh, even better, yes.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
And then all you have to do is use the cleansing heresy cast a spell on Dan. You get a war score bonus.
I will Condor all of you.
No,
good luck with that.
What's that mean?
It means he's going to declare a war on you, and then you're going to take all of his cities away from him.
Yeah, pretty much.
Number 5 from episode 235, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly for the War Score mechanic introduced in Civilization Beyond Earth.
The user Carl0413 noticed that the Firaxis team has introduced another new mechanic into diplomacy and the good old military conquest, the War Score mechanic.
Why does this sound familiar? Where have I heard this before?
We talked about this very briefly on the last episode, yes.
And I may or may not have 3,000 hours in the game with War Score.
Is it Paradox related? Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe. All right, maybe. Victoria 2.
Oh, here I was thinking it was Crusader Kings.
Not EU4?
No, like every game.
Well, I guess since EU4 had to steal the tall versus wide thing, Firaxis had to try and steal something back. And I think they got the better of the deal because tall versus wide is garbage.
Garbage. Seriously, tall versus wide in EU4 is an idiotic concept. Okay.
Yes.
So that was our negative. Let's talk about the positive.
At least now we're going to know exactly where we stand.
I think it depends on how it's tuned. Like, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with a war score concept. If you're really trashing somebody, then you could just kill them completely. So does this become useful, or do you just take what you want physically, as in you wreck them for their cities and then make them give you some money and resources, or do you just kill them outright?
I don't know. Whenever I see the word score and sift together, I do have this knee-jerk reaction that may not necessarily be positive.
It has the word war next to it, so it's probably better than the usual score.
Yeah. The concept is, if you've never heard of it, both sides get points during the war. I'm guessing killing units and taking cities count as points. Depending on the differential between those two, you get the ability to command stuff for peace. How well that's tuned is going to be very important. Because before, you could sit there and kill 100 AI units and they're like, nope, no peace, ever. Whereas if you actually have this sort of mechanic, you could wipe out their army 50 times and then they'd have to actually sort of make peace because clearly one-sided and clearly
failed.
Well,
they could force it on you in theory.
Yeah, that too.
But, it does bring back some thoughts along the lines of, okay, what if I just sit here and let the DDAI shred its forces on my military over and over again until I've killed, 50 units, then I can take everything but their capital or something.
Yeah.
So you can go off the deep end in both directions. You could make it a worthless mechanic where, in practice, it's not applied at all. Or you could make it the overwhelming dominant factor at war and just take everyone's cities using war score.
Yeah, well, the problem with the mechanic inherited from Civ 5 was that if you did not have units surrounding an AI city, it wouldn't think it was threatened. But if you took that city, it would really not think it's not threatened. And it constantly well, that's not my city anymore, so I don't know what you're talking about. At least with this concept, possibly, if you take the city, it will be part of the war score, and they'll be like, oh, that actually is important that I lost cities.
Yeah.
But what I'm hoping is, even if you do have the, okay, we're fighting out in the middle, I kill, say, 50 of your units because you just refuse to shut up, I don't even threaten your city, I'm not even in your zone, you shouldn't be able to start asking for a ton of cities. Like, there should be some basis in that mechanic that if you are taking cities, then maybe you can take more versus just, oh, I killed a lot of units. So that basically just means that I can force peace and maybe get some energy or other stuff off you. And maybe even one city at most, if it's a small one.
That would bring a much needed qualitative element to the quantitative. In other words, my army is really powerful. It's twice as powerful as yours. But your army's on the other side of the planet. So are you really threatening me just beyond words?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think the mechanic can add a lot of clarity to the whole war behavior of the AI, because we all know these deals where the AI knocks at your door and is like, hey, want to make peace? I want all your cities except your capital and all your gold. And then yeah. Like, oh, but you haven't killed a single unit from me yet. You haven't invaded my territory. And I don't understand. What? Yeah, that's...
Yeah, on what planet do you think that's acceptable terms?
Yeah, it's like, at least send something to me so I can kill it.
War score mechanic has to get tuned to prevent stuff like that, because Europa Universalis 3 had the same problem. You had like a minor nation approaching you, hey, want to make peace with me? You only have to release 4 small nations as France and give me all your gold and we're good. And basically the same situation. And it needs some AI tuning and behavior tuning, and then you can make a meaningful mechanic. It needs balancing, but in general, I think it's a really good idea. It's not bad to borrow stuff from other games.
Yeah, now this is definitely going to fix the bad part of war in the Civ-type series, games. Especially on higher difficulty, like, I got 1 million units, so what? Yes, there's questions about, does the AI understand that it shouldn't start a war if it can't do anything?
Well, it's just an AI problem in general, isn't it?
Yeah, but then the AI thinks it'll automatically win. It stops looking at its own army and starts looking at how is that army doing. And if it's 0-0 after like some number of turns, it should really just say, okay, well, that was stupid. Let's stop fighting.
That may also help with the, how come that civilization just declared war on me? They're on the other side of the planet.
Yeah.
How are you getting here? Magic?
You know. But there's another important component we haven't yet talked about, and I think one user voiced that, Josephia said, I'm worried about the lack of flexibility and bargaining capacity of the new diplomatic systems, and all I have seen is this white peace option, I think, in the last play. So we would have to think about what there are peace options that we have as a war score system. Can we demand cities? Can we demand resources, gold? I think it's also important what we can select as our peace options to make use of the war score.
I guess. I don't think that's such a big concern, though, because at the end of the day, you can just take all their cities still. So, I mean, what are they restricting? I mean, if they're restricting you from demanding money or resources, then yeah, it's a problem, but I don't anticipate that being the case. I don't see that as a big potential issue at all. Now, the tuning of it, yes, I mean, if you make it pointless, then that's not good, but in terms of demand flexibility, and there's very little now anyway. So, like, I don't see that being constrained in a material fashion.
I can kind of understand where that comment is coming from, though. I'm thinking more in the context of Civilization V, which, of course, Civilization Beyond Earth, at least Vanilla, took a lot from, or in some cases took away from, where you'd be in a peace treaty situation, and you're trying to give something. I wish I could remember, maybe someone could remember for me, but it says, oh, sorry, you can't actually include that as part of peace terms. You would have to then get peace and then have a separate deal for that particular thing.
What was that?
Yeah, what was that? Trying to remember.
Open borders?
I don't think it's open borders I'm thinking of specifically, but it's kind of one of those things where, why do I have to have peace first and then enter into a separate agreement for it?
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say, what are we going to be able to select with regards to war score?
Maybe it was a research agreement.
We demand a research agreement for peace.
Ah, yeah.
Well, that would actually get me to wage war.
If that's possible. I mean, it could work. Like,
yeah, it sounds silly.
It does sound silly.
I would have you down so you research with me. Come here.
Possible.
I don't know. I was kind of thinking more in the perspective of, like, I'm going to frickin' lose this war. If I don't do something, I don't want them to take my city, so here, how about we get a research agreement, because you're going to be better off with it than me in the sense of the research agreement, but I still stay alive. Thank you.
Oh, like a one-sided one? That's not a bad idea, actually.
Yes.
I think I could
I'll
work.
Give you research to not kill me.
Yeah?
Well, again,
you're extorting science. That's like extorting gold. You're extorting beakers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But can't you already do that in Beyond Earth? I mean, beakers are tradable via diplomacy, so you can demand them in a peace offer, can't you?
I guess it depends on what they do. If they are removing most of the trading system, then that will be a big question here. Can't barter anymore. which we'll get to in the next topic, but the cell seems to be connected anyways. Can you make peace? Because the peace screen was the same as the barter screen. And if you're not bartering, does that mean that they also change the peace fields? Like your war score determines what you get and it just tells you? Because that would be stupid.
Yeah, and I think that was the concern in the post I quoted, because we might be restricted in diplomacy by the war score system because we haven't seen anything except for the white piece yet.
Yeah, because he goes on to say, like, it feels like a replacement for a more flashy but less deep system. It feels like if I ask a plumber to fix the piping on my house to avoid leaks and he removes it fully and changes it to a top-notch hermetically closed water tank in the garage with equally most modern hermetically closed buckets to carry the water to the kitchen or the bathroom. Yes, the leaks are gone, but the system I wanted to correct too is also gone.
Yeah.
So is it one step forward, two steps back?
Maybe.
I don't know if the mechanic is finished yet or not. Probably not, but at the same time, a little more information would be helpful to have an idea of what can and cannot be included.
That's true. Although if it's not fleshed out yet on their end, then giving us a lot of information would probably be counterproductive because it's not finalized, and then there'd be expectations about it that would not be consistent with what comes out. So I can understand not going into too much detail until it's more solid. But just war and peace deals right now and in Civ games prior for a while have been sufficiently like lackluster in my mind that you'd have to botch this pretty badly to make it much worse.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like it's such a huge detriment to gameplay that it makes Civ fun to play, but as a mechanic, it can be improved so much, and it's not at such a state where it's so strong already that I feel like they're more likely than not to improve it in this case.
As is every instance of the war score mechanic we've seen, Gaga was saying, you know, it's white piece. We're not seeing examples of what we are going to be able to trade as opposed to not. Like, there's just no information there, so now it's completely in a vacuum, and it's just wild speculation. Well, certainly they must have an idea of something, maybe not everything that you can get in a peace deal, but something to help us fill in some of these blanks.
Well, keeping in mind that people have been using, like, alpha or beta builds, so it could be that the AI's war score peace treaty thresholds are set too high, and then white piece is too much. That could just be a pure balance number thing.
Yeah, that might be the case, right. I mean, you would have to teach the AI how to use the system anyway, so if that's not done properly yet, there's no reason to add these items to the negotiation table anyway.
Civ 5, the way the peace deals went, they had set levels, and once you get up to a certain level, you get some stuff. But the AI doesn't know how to negotiate. You might be able to get, say, start getting cities in peace deals, and it will say, okay, you can have these cities. But maybe you want all their resources and other stuff, put those in with a couple less cities, and then you say, how about this? And it's like, no, you can only have all these cities.
So yeah, I remember such a situation.
Improving that by deleting it and replacing it with a war score mechanic seems like not a bad concept.
Yeah, it might be easier for the AI to understand by giving things a numerical value.
Yeah.
So you have earned, you can buy this much stuff in a peace deal, and the cities are worth a big amount, and these other things you want worth a smaller amount, you can get a bunch of those small things as opposed to taking the cities. And it will understand that is an equivalent.
Math is easier if things are itemized.
Yes. See, we're being positive.
See?
I don't care about being positive. I'm an evil troll.
You're positive about being an evil troll, then?
Very well.
Now, of course, the weighting of those numbers, I'm sure, will cause all sorts of consternation.
Number 4, from episode 230, simulating immigration and emigration in Civ gameplay, specifically, is examined.
Zipliner posted a little thing about refugees and immigration, because every war results in a mass exodus of its citizens. Well, not every war, maybe, but exodus of its citizens to safe havens. Does not need to be due to war, of course. Bad economy or natural disasters can also result in a refugee crisis of neighboring nations. What I did wonder was how this could be represented in Civ 5 or Civ 6. It seems too important to be missed out, and it could be used as a deterrent for too much war between nations. Well, we don't have to worry about the disasters so much, since we don't have random events.
Okay. Not every conquest is the Mongol conquest, and most conquests in Civ are on the scale of dozens of years in the early game and still many years in the later game, to the point where modeling this would be problematic because max exoduses that are temporary would have happened and come back inside a few turns.
Or even within a turn.
So like the old war weariness thing from Civ 4 kind of sort of modeled this. I don't know if you need much else. I don't think it really, I don't know.
Well, okay, how about this? When you take a city, half the population just up and disappears.
That's true.
Where'd they go? Is everybody running around?
So there's a lot of angry people, too, so that's true. It is abstracted reasonably well as it stands.
But they didn't go
anywhere. I know. They evaporate into thin air right now. What if it's a size 6 city you take and it goes down to 3? What if one or two of those missing population points isn't the casualties, but it goes into another city nearby or across the border into another Civ?
Yeah. What if they moved?
You have starvation. You have Civs benefiting at random from other wars. I don't know that it adds a lot to the game. You could do it. I don't think it'd make much difference, so it wouldn't hurt much either. But
I mean, it would help with push population. Now, granted, if Civ 5 had citizen-specific data set, kind of like more like Civ 4-ish, where the citizens individually had religion and the citizens individually had a culture.
And if it was still too much culture to their culture as opposed to yours,
all of a sudden you have a war and Civ A is pushing Civ B's population into Civ C.
Yep.
And you're just kind of shoving the population forward, kind of like what happened when the Huns wrecked Rome. Or wrecked the tribes and did the great migration to shove them all into Rome.
Yeah, there's two AI players or a human player and AI player going, you're sitting over here as player C and going, thanks for the free pop, guys.
Right up until your empire falls because you have too much of their free pop and they don't like you.
Yeah, without the culture part, I mean, at least.
Yeah, if you tied that sort of thing in. But then you could also tie stuff in, actually, Noah, not the Ark. With the double X on either side, because you have to have that. Talked about emigration mod in there, where it does something similar, but also revolves around prosperity. So if your population's starving in a city, instead of dying, there's no food here. I'm going to that city, which actually has food, and move that way. Or if you don't produce enough local happiness, then the people in your city might head over to a place that does have local happiness benefits, and then move that way.
Which may or may not be a city of your own.
Yeah.
Mm.
It'd
be interesting. It's a little odd in an abstraction of 20-year terms, but I wouldn't be opposed to it.
Yeah, you'd have to put more emphasis back on the citizen. You could have, say, the Great Migration exists in-game, which did take place over a long period of time, so it'd be fine in the game. But then you'd also want to have government policies or other such things for handling those things. So do you have a government that says, we don't like you. You can stay over there in that refugee camp and get out of our territory because we'll kill you if you show up. Versus, sure, come on over. Everybody together. We're all happy.
Together. Yeah.
You can add more depth to the game related around that. Not a bad concept, but you'd have to change the game to make citizens important and then modify a lot of mechanics around it.
And so then the question becomes, would all that effort be worth it?
Sure.
Yeah, if it was
done well.
So this is definitely something, let's try to put it into like a next Civ title as opposed to try to backfill into an existing title because so much would have to change. It's not one of those, let's just add it as an existing system and then it plays well with the other mechanics because there's a ripple effect. It's substantial enough for it to be meaningful and not just be just shoved in there.
Yeah, especially if you go back to military units requiring a population point to make them. And then the question is, hey, look, I'm using all these culture Y people as my military because that happened in reality. Mm-hmm. We don't want to use our people for it. We're just going to use yours.
Yeah, here, you guys go over here and do all the dying things.
Yeah, that's a great way to do that. Except then
they
all turn around and then their loyalty becomes questionable unless if you start becoming unhappy, unless they were completely merged in. Maybe you can make the unique units of a Civ if you have their population, and they had already made it to that tech.
And in that city or cities where they have the presence.
Yeah, obviously. Would not be good for casual players, though, I think.
Why am I losing all my stuff?
Why did all my military units turn around and declare new Russia?
Mm-hmm.
What's with that?
You could have consequences of not playing with that. Well, of course, scale with difficulty. So the newer players, more casual players, would be on the lower difficulty. So like with anything else, it wouldn't penalize them as much.
Number 3 from episode 233. What is old being new again through a revisit and possible return of past Civ mechanics?
So what old feature would you like back for the next Civ? I guess we're back to mainline Civ and the fantasy existence of Civ 6. We Own the Purple made a post. He wants to go back to the Alpha Centauri nuke system. Basically, just one nuke wrecks everything. Doesn't matter what it's there. No half population loss, blah, blah, blah. made the nukes more high stakes, and everybody hates you if you didn't remove the prohibition on using them. And then he asks, you know, general question of, what about everybody else? What do you want back?
I know this is all like going to be, okay, what do you want to see? So it's strict opinion, but I don't want to see Planet Busters and Mainline Civ.
Yeah.
First, from a gameplay perspective, nukes are already strong enough relative to other military units as is. They are already devastating and have been for pretty much every Civ game ever, to the point where they can trump even more advanced technology until you get some kind of countermeasure. And even then, it's hard. They're very, very strong as is, so you don't need to see them stronger. And also, we don't have nukes that are like planet busters in reality. I mean, they're very, very powerful, but on the scale of like a 20-year advancement, complete removal of everything, including all the surrounding tiles, given what all the surrounding tiles are supposed to represent, we don't have that kind of power in one nuke, guys.
There are several things that I would like back. I like the health system in Civ 4. I like the wonders that were dependent on certain resources, like ivory for the Statue of Zeus, copper for Colossus, stuff like that. I like the Civ 2 advisors. I know that was mentioned in the list in there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I definitely second that one.
I also liked a couple world wonders from Civ 2, which was Leonardo's workshop, which gave three upgrades to your units.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, no. If they gave you that back, they would nerf it so hard.
Yeah, I
yeah,
know. Yeah, that can't come back.
But, or you know, just modify it for something else, because I just like the sound of Leonardo's workshop. Then I also like the Sun Tzu's War Academy. I like the name of it mostly, but I think it's a barracks in every city or something like that.
Yeah.
And I also missed the corporations. I thought those were fun. I know some people feel that they were like overpowered or maybe too cheesy, but I like the idea of them. That would be nice to have them back. I like the rendered city maps that were in Civ 2 and Civ 1, where you can see all your buildings and all the world wonders that are in it. I guess you sort of have it now, but it's not quite the same as being zoomed in. As
well,
as
before as well. But it's so overcrowded on the main map.
Yeah,
everything's shoved into a single tile, so you can't see much.
Yeah, there's no spread.
I would like to see some tweak between Civ 4 maintenance and Civ 5 happiness. I really liked the individual city feel from Civ 4 and the way it meshed with empire management. I like social policies as a concept. I see something similar to civics brought in alongside it. But specifically just that individual city management aspect. You can still tile micro in Civ 5 and you can still plan your cities, but you don't have the same degree of specialization possible. And you don't have the same city level consideration because happiness is global. And that's a little confusing, first off. But aside from the confusing factor, like, you don't have individual cities getting upset. You don't have individual city health problems. And that's something that could be taken to a higher level than it has been previously, even with how trade routes are working in Civ 5. You could really mess with resource distribution in an empire and have that be an engaging system. So I would like to see some of the city-specific stuff brought back from Civ 4 and built upon using some of the concepts that Civ 5 has shown us so far.
Well, more detailed Civ.
Yeah.
The city is the important thing in the Civ, and it shouldn't be just generically global stuff attached to it. Most of the things Scott mentioned are mentioned in the thread. Otherwise, we've got governments, so passive bonuses and changing the way your empire reacts to your actions, usual civics, health, era-specific music, and leader heads.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice touch.
Seeing me blinking at the toe gun, Civ 3 was always amusing.
Yeah. Civ 3, 4, BE-style espionage. I don't know. I wouldn't want the Beyond Earth and Civ whatever to have the same style of everything, because then that's kind of, you're just playing the same game.
There are just some things that that's being able to do, like trading maps and having permanent alliance in Civ 4. I thought those were useful things to do, but
diplomacy side, yeah.
Yeah, bringing back permanent alliances and building on it would be a huge bonus, and we have talked about that on previous episodes. It would be very nice to see that back as well.
Another thing I've missed is, I know in Civ 1, you could see your citizens, and they would have them representing the happiness level, and there would be like a group of unhappy or content or happy citizens or rebel citizens, and they would all dress differently. I liked that. Yeah.
Pop level, like individual citizen level religion,
yeah,
and individual city level.
Oh, well, the city culture was like X percent one and X percent the other.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like over the tiles.
Yeah, this dude is German, that dude is American. and this dude over here likes Buddhism, and that dude over there likes Catholicism, and that would be cool to bring that actual level of depth back in, because then you can play with lots of mechanics related to nationalists later in the game, or just religious conversion or hatred and stuff like that.
Keep in mind, Civ 5 is the closest when it comes to religious distribution, actually. Civ 4 had the culture split based on percentages and the tile of how much culture was generated there. But when it came to religion, Civ 4 was very generic compared to Civ 5 by comparison. Every religion was identical, and if you had multiple religions in a city, it just had multiple religions in a city. That was it. You could build the buildings, and, okay, maybe the Apostolic Palace would come into play or something. But for the most part, if you had an extra religion in the city, it just gave you an extra happiness and free religion and not a whole lot else.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's not really brought back. It would be cool to see, though, I agree.
Where that should be an actual conflict in the game. You have these multiple religions, there should be tension or issues or whatever.
Depending on how your nation is, how much that would be a factor, yeah.
That would probably have to come in with the Civic. If you had to bring back something like Civics, where you basically decided, you know, are you working on tolerance? Are you working on religious persecution? Things like that.
Yeah. And then if you tie in with the nationalists, it's like, oh, do we let the German Protestants come visit us because we're also Protestant? Or do we just hate the Germans too much?
So basically, Civilization Universalis.
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah. But, EU doesn't even come close to that sort of thing. Get really deep into the population, and that would bring back like the civic style, and you can make choices over the years. Otherwise, one of the more important points made in the thread, barb cities.
Oh, yes, yes. I do not mind barb cities.
Barb their cities.
Because at least then you know exactly where they are and where to put the army instead of them randomly popping up that one tile you couldn't see. I mean, yeah. Not that they could still do that, but still, you know.
I think that might bring those that get upset at that kind of thing. Like, why are you calling them barb, this culture and their...
If they have a city, are they really barbarians?
Yeah.
Maybe. They're organized barbarians. How about that?
Well, you know, it's like organized crime, I guess. Right?
Yeah. The concept, anyways, going from people living in huts to actually controlling territory, that would be cool. Because the New World scenario in older Civs was much more amusing. You know, the barbs actually controlled most of the lands.
You came in and there was like five or six barb cities and all that.
Yeah.
So they have to reconcile that in Civ, though.
Maybe just change the name to so minor, not that's not even a city-state.
And Civ 4 had something called a minor nation that the game virtually never used outside of mods. Like, I think by default they're at war with everyone, but you could make peace. It was a weird mechanic that was underused outside of world builder scenarios. And I played with it a little bit when I was still making maps in the Civ 4 strategy and tips thing. So they had something like that that would have been cool to have on, like, a Terra map. But I think there's a fundamental issue with Terra maps in Civ games, and that's just that because you start off in what's effectively a Pangaea with all the other nations, killing people in the old world is just overwhelmingly dominant iteration of Civ.
Well, even sending a
it takes too long. It takes too long for to investment in the New World to pay off, and it's even worse in Civ 5 because of the per city penalties. But the maintenance and delay in Civ 4 made it problematic too, because like you couldn't just bulb astronomy and send cities over there; you'd bankrupt.
Yeah.
Whereas if you waited for state property or you know other things to mitigate the maintenance, try and build Forbidden Palace over there, limit the number of cities, then it took so long to actually get use out of that that you would have been better off just conquering double the land on the original continent and winning the game.
It's never been modeled properly in Civ.
Yeah.
We have a couple points raised in chat. Star of Hope says, Endless Legend does barbarians with depth well. You can kill and then later rebuild the villages, bribe or complete a quest to make them friendly or part of your empire. Which are all there things was, that I think would translate well into Civ.
Yeah.
There was a Civ 4 scenario where you played as the barbarians and you went out and just conquered as the barbarians.
That's part of the Warlords expansion, yeah.
Yeah, yes it was.
And you couldn't play it outside of Warlords, which is why I didn't use it a lot, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Number 2, from episode 231, the extent of which the term cheat is loaded in Civilization gameplay.
How many of you cheat with playing single player? And this is poll. We all know Dan loves his polls.
Oh, but it's a multi-option poll.
Yes.
It's true. It's true.
The different choices was I'll re-roll a start I don't like. Second option was I'll load an earlier save game if something doesn't go my way. I use Info Attic to see information not available in the game. I assume that's a mod.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
I use Unbalanced Mods, Brazil, All You Need, American Domination, etc. I'll use IGE to add things in my favor. Is that like a world
in-game
map?
Editor.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Next one is I'll use exploits like Pillage Heal. I'm not sure what he means by that.
Bring a worker to go with you to that you can pillage somebody else's tile and then use the worker to fix it.
Pillage again? Okay.
Yeah.
I'll only play a top-tier civilization, Babylon 1.
I don't think that counts as a cheat. It's in the game.
A couple of these are pretty obviously not cheats. They don't set the definition, but whatever.
In fairness to the thread starter, he does put cheats in quotation marks, but still, some of these choices, I'm like, there's some loaded terminology here and qualifications as well, but yeah, we'll get to more of that.
You should have rephrased that option using a sieve like a crutch, like you only use one sieve, but even then it's not really a cheat.
It's just a preference.
Yeah.
Like that's
the people like their crutch.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm
just getting in the spirit of the OP here. Come on.
I know.
As far as I'm concerned, I have rerolled starts I didn't like, especially if they were horrible starts. I had a little bad habit in Civ 4 rerolling. I was like, I want gold or gems. And now it doesn't matter in Civ 5. I have reload earlier save games all the time. I did realize this was a issue apparently now with save scumming. I thought it was a physical way to play. It's an issue with some people.
Well, the qualification, if something doesn't go my way, I've loaded an earlier save game, even if something did go my way, just to try something different.
I mean, it's single player. They can do whatever they want, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about Iron Man only style and that's somewhat more recent and generally only higher level play.
There are older games that would do Iron Man stuff, but
But the whole save scumming, blah blah blah, and negative connotation to that is much more recent.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it's that recent. Civ 4 Hall of Fame ran that for pretty much the entire time, and they had
so
if you reloaded it, they'd be like, not acceptable save.
But that's the Hall of Fame, though. They want nice, clean games for comparison to other people. That's very different than just playing a game.
But that was the origin of Iron Man in the first place.
Nah, it was around before that, too.
Well, sure, but I mean, that concept, what you're looking for, comparable scenario to other players and a challenge to yourself.
Yeah.
But both of those are legitimate elements to playing Iron Man. And Iron Man goes back to really early stuff, probably at least in the original Fire Access game.
Quite frankly, there are some games where you can't. No, I know this is outside of Civ.
Oh, XCOM.
I'm just thinking, there's some games where it's like, well, that wasn't even a choice, so.
Yep. FTL comes to mind.
Don't starve. It's not a choice.
Don't starve comes to mind.
Yeah.
It's not a choice. You die, you're dead. They delete the save
game. Like Iron Man XCOM, like the first XCOM, if you want it.
You know, my mentality is usually I don't expect to win every game of Civ that I start, and so that I've gotten to a point where I can't win, or I don't think I'm going to win, I usually just start again with a new game or start the same game from turn one, but very rarely do I try to do something like, oh, I lost that wonder, I better go back 10 turns and see if I can improve my production. That's kind of cheap.
I mean, yeah, you can do that. In Civ or any other game, if you save scum, it's kind of like, I don't reload, and so the consequence is having to deal with that choice, or I do reload, and the consequence is now to play these turns over again.
It's still a learning experience to me, though, because I used to play Sierra games, which pretty much trained you to save and make multiple saves, and death was around every single frickin' corner.
That was part of the design in those games, man.
Yeah. But I mean, Fuzzy just pointed out, reloading a game to see if you can get that world wonder, if it was actually possible or not. I actually see that as a learning experience, going back and seeing, okay, was there a better strategy I could have done?
No, sure, but if you do that, do you count it as a win if you win the game?
Yes.
Well, here's the thing, though. Even if you win the game or lose the game, you can save it at certain strategic points and compare, and that's very powerful.
It's a Hall of Fame, but for a personal win, yes, learned, okay, I should have done this strategy worked, the other one didn't. So long as that's just a roll of the dice.
Yeah, what he's won is knowledge on whether or not you can or not do it. If you are purely learning a game, then Iron Man tends to be the worst thing because you can't necessarily learn on Iron Man.
Well, no, I think you learn in that situation. You learn to hate the game.
Yeah, it depends on how interested in the game you are and how interested you want to restart constantly. But really, I mean, when it comes to Civ, the only time that Iron Man-ish style matters is if you're going to compare in the Game of the Month stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know why Hall of Fame got put in there, because Hall of Fame is all-inclusive of mass reroll until they get a good start.
Oh, yeah.
As far as the whole bringing a worker with you and healing the tile improvements and then repillaging them, it's not something I've ever done. I don't think it's something that you should have to do. A little bit as an exploit. It's built into the game, so I guess it's possible, but if that's what it takes for you to conquer a city, then maybe you should just bring in a couple extra units with you instead.
I have no problem with people doing stuff like that at all. No problem.
I know you don't, because you play on a high level.
That kind of stuff is not necessarily beneficial either. You know, someone who exploits different games extensively, if you just go using exploits willy-nilly, you can cost yourself instead.
Yeah, especially if those exploits get closed, and then you find out, oh, I don't know how to play this game.
Well, that's true, yeah. Right? Even if they exist forever. You don't always want to be doing that, because that worker costs you in stuff to build, too. It can't attack the city, and so if you're not damaging the city enough, you're screwed. And on top of that, otherwise you're taking away a worker who's probably trying to build you useful improvements. It can be helpful if you need it. It's certainly an exploit that can give you an advantage. But if you're just using that every opportunity you get, nope, you're going to wind up behind.
You can steal their worker as you go in. And
sure, you can.
The cost of the worker is balanced by the fact that every turn you're pillaging. And when you pillage, you don't just heal, you get money. So you've paid for that worker as well.
Assuming you got it there.
That makes it sound like not an exploit, because there are...
No, it's totally an exploit. You should not be able to improve...
It
doesn't feel like the Civ 1 exploits, where you can have a granary for like 80 turns being on build, and then switch it to the pyramids and instant build it. That's an exploit.
Oh, I loved contacting the AI over and over and over again. They get really angry and declare on you because you try to talk to them too often. You can even do that to other human players, contacting them over and over, and they get pissed off and declare on you. If they didn't have a choice, the game would force them to declare.
In this pool, the third and the fourth items, first off, I used Info Addict to see information not available in the game, and then I used Unbalanced Mods.
Those are two different things.
Info Addict to see information not available in the game. It's not so much that the information is not available, it's that it's hidden.
And it's not that it's hidden necessarily, it's also that it's not really put in a way that's easily usable.
What information? It doesn't really feel like a cheat if it's there.
What kind of information would it provide? Could allegedly give you an unfair advantage.
Yeah.
You can see information about the game while you're in the diplomacy screen, where normally you don't, and you have to make decisions based on if you remember what was going on in the game before you hit the diplomacy screen.
Yeah.
And maybe even calculations based on information in the game, so you don't have to do it in your head. But
it doesn't feel cheaty.
Well, as compared to Unbalanced Mods, it's not really cheaty, because it's not modifying the game necessarily.
Yeah,
it is modifying
the modification to the game mechanics.
Yeah, it's modification of the information you get to see, but...
And modification of the user interface, not the actual gameplay itself.
Yeah.
And of course, using the in-game editor to add change things in your favor.
Yeah, that's...
Okay, yeah, that...
Yeah, that's...
That's bad.
That is
I mean, that's like taking steroids in Major League Baseball game or something like that.
No, this is called removing the players from the outfield.
And making all the balls go right directly to the bat.
And in the thread itself, there was also qualitative discussion in terms of some of the terminology, specifically with regards to what is a cheat. Someone pulled out the definition of to deprive of something valuable by the use of deceit or fraud.
Mm-hmm.
As KRC says, you can certainly fool yourself, but you're not cheating yourself. There is no deceit. It's not as though you didn't watch yourself do those things. There is no fraud. There is no cover-up. Okay, it's kind of like laws and rules. All laws are rules, but not all rules are laws. And I think by fooling yourself, depending upon what it is that you are doing in terms of a cheat, because some of these on the poll are much more of a quote-unquote cheat than others, and how often you're doing it and how much of a habit is there, because in a way, yeah, you are cheating yourself. If you're fooling yourself and then you're cheating yourself out of the experience, then if that somehow gets patched or you decide that you want to start comparing to other people's performances or you're trying to understand what it is that you're doing incorrectly, you're going to end up handicapping yourself or get yourself down a path, find it very difficult to compare and improve your performance because people are going to be like, well, why are you doing that? Don't do that.
You say, oh, I can win on deity, but you're always clicking legendary star. Then are you really winning on deity?
If you're playing on deity and you choose legendary start, then you can say, I won on deity with a legendary start. You're still one.
There's like an asterisk there on the win on deity.
Well, the problem is, when do you stop taking off the asterisks?
Maybe we need to move from asterisks and just have in-text citations, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, have little notes. Like, how crazy do we want to get here?
Yep. Although Dino mentions in the thread that he doesn't really consider that reloading the start is necessarily cheating because you basically didn't play the game.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Some point later in the game, you do the whole revert 10 turns, 20 turns. You're on the line, you know.
Well, no, listen, if you're a science fiction fan, just view a reload this way. It's an alternate universe.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's how I do Kerbal Space Program. World. Oh, that was just a simulation.
You can take all of those reloads and all those experiences and then apply it to another game. And even though you didn't reload that game, you had a comparable circumstance in a previous game. So have you, in fact, fooled yourself and cheated yourself? See, these are the kind of things that just
keep you up at night.
Just disintegrates the cheating argument here.
But I like what Tribe Fanatic said in this thread. I tried not to abuse, for lack of a better term, the AI too much. Games just become too easy and if you subvert the intentions of the game. And that's something that I personally, as a player, take very seriously throughout my gaming, is trying not to subvert the intentions of the designers of the game.
And then you get into questions of what really was the intent.
Yeah.
Is this a feature?
Yeah, or is this, you know, this hasn't been fixed over X patches. At which point does that go from, I don't believe it was the intention, to, well, the game dev hasn't bothered fixing it, so...
The only response I could say to that is that I know it when I see it.
I'm surprised stealing city-state workers wasn't on the list. I mean, if they're going to do the pillage hill on the list, stealing city-state workers has caused more trouble than that.
Number 5 from episode 225.
Strategic resources, luxury resources, all of these kinds of resources can be found on tiles. Speaking of tiles...
Are you tiling?
Ah!
That's hard work. I don't want
to... Are we messing with your bathroom now? I'm not helping you with that, man.
Get down on your knees.
You.
It's time for the grout.
Oh, boy.
That's quite all right. I wouldn't want you to touch my bathroom.
Hey-o.
Number 4 from episode 231.
Episode 198, 13 months ago, Steve. That was your first
13
time.
Months?
Mm-hmm.
13 months?
Where the hell does time go?
I don't know.
Mac and I are thinking, really.
Yeah, we know.
Mackie and I do not want to express in months how long we've been on this show.
No. I don't want to do the math.
Except, you know, I'm doing math right now. I'm figuring it out.
I don't know
what you're about
it. I'm doing it, Mackie.
No, not math.
Oh, my gosh. By the end of this year, it'll be over 100.
Ah.
Oh, shit. It already is.
Number 3 from episode 219.
I suppose it's actually kind of nice to see that people wanted to hear more about our stories specifically. And, of course, most of the stories I remember I would rather forget because they really tick me off. So I don't know if I want to share that with other people.
You seem to be on the receiving end of a lot of those, though, so you have such a good story.
Plus there's that whole Turncast thing. So
play together. Turncast kind of plays.
Yeah, I guess if you really want talk of previous Civ games, Turncast is the place
to go. And also if you want humorous things, Turncast is a place to go.
Yeah.
We're only funny incidentally on Polycast.
By accident.
Censored slightly less on Turncast, but just slightly.
Just slightly.
Actually, no, that's probably not true. It's probably the opposite.
Number 2 from episode 234.
I think that brings us to the end.
I believe it does. Tom?
Well, now... Dan, you messed me up, man, because the one part I got was the intro. You took that away from me.
Now you have the exit.
You have the closing.
It's like I didn't practice this.
I'm always asleep at the closing. Remember?
It's the same as the intro. It's in reverse.
Number 1 from episode 232. Why are score and victory conditions eternal grounds for debate? Here's why.
So this is by McClimes. One thing that's always bugged me in Civ is the way victory conditions are so all or nothing. Once everyone is buying my blue jeans, no one else can be elected world leader or into space. So here's my idea how to alter it. It is a Civilization VI idea, victories and coalitions. So the first part is we get rid of the World Congress completely.
Yay!
Reuse that mechanic. Coalitions. Not every nation must be a member of a coalition, and there can be multiple coalitions existing at once. No nation can be a member of more than one coalition. Coalitions would function exactly like the World Congress, but only in regards to their member nations. There would also be a few new resolutions to propose pass, as well as some modifications to existing ones. I mean, the biggest issue with the World Congress and the United Nations, and then... from Civilization before that is, guess what? Everybody's in it once it's founded. And you're forced in it. You got to stay in it.
Yep.
It's always been incongruous with the rest of the game mechanics.
Yeah, especially when they do something like ban luxury and you can't tell them to F off.
Yeah.
At least in Civ 4, you could defy the resolution. It gave you an
And even in Alpha Centauri, there was a global council type thing. If you didn't agree with their decisions, you could say, well, screw that. I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah, and that's more like the real world. Just because the UN passes something doesn't mean that any country has bothered to pass it.
Yeah, if you want to be part of a coalition where it's do as we say, not as we do, then sure, go for it.
Yep.
So, yes, you've got free passage, that's open borders. Defensive treaty, that's a defensive pact. Declare war is declare war.
What?
Entire coalition declares war. I know, crazy, right? Then we have official ideology and official religion, and they sound similar, but as proposed, they're actually not. Because an official religion, that religion spreads 5 times strength amongst coalition members, and all other religions are half as effective, and the Holy City gives its owner a few extra votes in the coalition. Although I guess that would assume that the person who holds the Holy City would be in the coalition. But then official ideology, all members of the coalition must convert to the chosen ideology or be kicked out of the coalition.
Ow.
Nah. I would assume that the diplo relations between people of different ideologies would be sufficient that you wouldn't get in the coalition in the first place if you were a different ideology.
Unless it's an ancient era coalition.
Yeah.
Well, there are some people that suggest coalitions should not be allowed at the beginning of the game, but something that comes about as of ideology founding.
Hmm.
I wonder if we're really treating a symptom as opposed to a cause when we do that.
I think his whole thrust really is to bring back the ability to have treaties, the ability to have not necessarily coalitions per se, but alliances.
This looks like a much better fleshed out concept of the Civ 4 permanent alliance setup, where you could have more than just two people sharing a victory depending on the game. And while the tuning looks awful to me, I don't think it's a bad idea. The only caveat is, since this is a proposal for Civ 6, we have no idea what the mechanics of Civ 6 will be like. Like, there's no guarantee that there'll be such a thing as an ideology in Civ 6. There might be, but there might not be.
Yeah.
But I don't mind it. I like this as a concept, actually.
Yeah, though actually one of the nicer things I like in the coalition side of things is that declare war is a vote. So unlike in Beyond Earth, where you, hey, you guys want to ally? Okay, let's ally. Oh, guess what? Declare war. You're all at war now, suckers. Defensive treaty as a separate thing for offense, like switching offense and defense. So you can have a coalition that's for trade or one for defense and or offense. That's all good.
The one that really raised my eyebrows, although definitely the ideology-related eyebrows, shared discoveries. When researching a new technology, a member only needs 1/3 of the normal science. If another member of that coalition already has that technology, I am on board with this.
I'll be over here with my one city, and I will coalition with all the major civs and let them do all the research.
No, that's not balanced.
I'll be like, let's see. Hey,
yeah, or you could just spam cities and let other people do all the researching for you, and then you know, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. I worry about that stuff would have to be changed.
I gotta say, the reactions to shared discoveries is interesting to me, because even with the strength of that proposal as it stands, it is still weaker than tech trade abuse in Civ 4.
Oh, like,
we've come a long way.
Yes.
We've come a long way when there are strong reactions to shared discoveries making a tech cost 1/3 of the science. But that's really interesting to me, the community shifted to that extent.
That's the thing. I mean, even if you think reality, say shared discoveries, the U.S. has a lot of military-industrial complex stuff. They make a new toy. They don't give that tech blueprint style to every member of NATO. They won't. They will sell them, and the selling of those arms usually comes with caveats, as in you can't use them in this style or resell it. But shared in the respect of, we have this new tech, we'll come build it or sell it to you. Or in the case of a building or some other thing, I'll come build it in your territory if you let me have the money. That makes sense, but there's no, here's the blueprint for this new shiny weapon.
Well, no, and they're not getting the tech instantly either. I mean, the 1/3 might be a bit much, but it makes sense that there's some. I mean, the fact that someone else knows a tech should make it cheaper. I mean, if you're going to go with realism, although Civ 5 doesn't really go for much realism.
But thinking back to Civ 4 Internet.
Well, not like that, but I mean, just it's easier for, say, a country that doesn't know too much about, say, making televisions now to make televisions than it would have been 100 years
ago.
That's
because the company in the place that does know how to make televisions went and built a manufacturing base over
that's
in that
true.
Other country. That's
but
why.
There's no reason that couldn't happen in game except for military techs, which you're trying to protect the secrets. But not all techs in the games are really necessarily military techs on every instance.
No,
and you
no.
build a manufactory in someone else's country, and yeah, I mean, they'd be able to look at that and be like, hey, we could build factories too. You do have more access to technology with nations that are friendly to you, working with you, fighting alongside you than you would otherwise. We're more likely to swap stuff with allies. I guess my point is their discount is strong, but it's not a bad idea within the framework of this concept.
I'd say 2/3 at that point.
Well, that's why this is good, that this is the Civilization 6 proposal, as opposed to let's figure out a way to mod, say, Civilization 5 to do this. Because then all those things that are under the hood, you can talk about that as well and then what the implications
are. And throw out all the bad ideas that are under the hood already.
Space colonization. While active, any spaceship parts built by members of the coalition are pooled together to create a shared spaceship.
Hmm.
When the ship launches, this resolution is voided. To build another shared ship, the resolution must be passed again. I assume that means to build another shared ship part. The current leader of the coalition is considered, for victory purposes, to be the one who launched the ship.
So you better be the leader of the coalition if you want to win.
Yeah.
And the thing is, this is what confused some people, because later on he clarified saying, oh, no, if the coalition wins, then it's a shared victory. But then when you do tell us that the current leader of the coalition is considered for victory purposes, that led to people saying, wait a minute, so the current leader of the coalition then is the one that's going to win if, while they are the leader, the coalition gets two, and this is where the second part of it comes in, victory points.
Since it's not an endgame finish the spaceship and win thing, that's actually not so bad. But then again, I think most people would prefer some sort of mid-step in there, like shared space parts for International Space Station, colony on Mars, or something like that, where you do all share before being able to create that giant spaceship that goes out of the planetary system.
Now, what actually caught my attention more about this was the victory points initially, just because of how much we love the current scoring in the Civilization franchise.
Whee!
I read the coalition part afterwards, even though we talked about coalitions first. When doing the math, okay, he talks about fractional victory points are rounded down, but that's the whole thing. Victory points. And he does say, these are loose numbers. I doubt it is balanced at all. This is just to give a vague example. And I would say, as a side, it's true we're not really going to know if it's going to be balanced until you actually test it. But when you see some of the numbers, whether it's an absolute number or a relative number, you have to question even before you test it, which kind of gets to this shared discoveries thing that we were getting to before. Population. Every point of population is worth one. Victory point.
Meh.
Tourism. You get a percentage of the population points of all other civs based on your cultural influence with them at 1/5 the value. So, Mongolia has 100 population. You are 20% influential with them. So you would have +4 victory points based on your tourism with Mongolia. Space. When a successful space colonization launch is achieved, that civilization gets 30 victory points. Multiple space launches can be achieved even by the same civilization. So when I read that civilization gets 30 victory points, so that's who the current leader of the coalition is for victory purposes, because they are the one who launched the spaceship.
Yeah.
Technology. Every technology researched is worth 3 victory points. Oh, you mean like looking at the literacy percentage and the demographics and of kind of like, what's going on here? I'm farther down in the technology tree than you are down this path. Oh, that's because I went and I backfilled a whole bunch of cheaper technologies. Economics. Every 10 gold in your income, not stored cash, I'm glad this was included.
Not stored cash.
It comes to the AI, is worth 1 victory point. So, for example, if you are at +22 gold, you gain 2 victory points. I'm thinking, wow, trade routes as if they weren't already important become even more important. And also, can I be Venice? I get the extra trade routes.
Mm-hmm.
Although, if you had this type of tuning, then the pop would wreck you.
Yeah. I think his point is that somebody who is highly economic should be able to gain points versus somebody who is highly conquesting, aggressive, or massive tourism-ish, whatever. He's trying to throw some ability to play in different styles, which is fine, except that some of them obviously are just going to be taken by everybody.
Yes. Then conquest, if one of your cities was founded by a different civilization than your own, its population is worth 25% more victory points. So a conquered city of 10 population is worth 12 victory points instead of the normal 10 victory points, as opposed to a city of 10 population that you founded.
Imagine. Yes. I will sell you a city. Will you sell me a city?
Okay. Awesome. No coalition, man.
This bonus does not apply if the original founder is a member of the same coalition as you.
Oh.
And seeing as how you can only be in one coalition at the time, as was described here...
I would let people be members of multiple coalitions. I would just actually switch the word coalition for treaty organizations. And I would let people be part of multiple treaty
that
organizations.
That convolutes the victory, though.
Except that you would have to modify some of the other stuff. But there's different types of treaty organizations. Like, you could just, say, make an economic one.
So then the options that you have within that coalition, if it was an economic coalition, would not be the same necessarily as the options you would have with other coalitions.
Yes. But I would say there'd be only one defensive treaty slash war treaty type coalition that you're allowed to join. But, say, you could be part of multiple economic ones, maybe multiple scientific or tourism cultural ones. Whatever.
Probably just even simplify it to just saying there are X amount of coalitions of X type and you can join one of each type. Because if you can join too many economic ones, you lose sort of a block play you create. Because while it's realistic of multiple coalitions, you also want the coalitions to go up against each other. If people are just sort of bunched up in lots of economic coalitions, you don't get any of that gameplay element at least.
Yeah, but then you would have certain points where like the East versus West and different coalitions like that for, I mean, even just thinking current economic treaties where, you know, you'd have like the European Free Trade Zone and the U.S. Free Trade Zone, and then you'd have a country like Canada being part of each. And therefore, both of those blocks would be able to funnel money into through Canada to get into the other block, but they can't go direct. So possible that the founder of the economic one has to have issues or something. I mean, there's ways to rewrite that all in there to make sure that there is blocks and that the people in Poland are minimal.
It says, where this gets fun is that coalitions combine their victory points. So if a coalition has three members and they each have 40 victory points, the coalition's victory point total is 120. Okay. So the game is won when you or the coalition you are a member of account for 70% of all total victory points accumulated worldwide. And my favorite comment was pointing out from question time, wouldn't the first person to get a single victory point instantly win the game due to having 100% of the victory points?
Yes.
So then McClime says, I suppose you'd have to build in a buffer at first. No, there's no supposing.
All you would need is just a minimum amount that you need to win so that you can't win with like 5 points or 1 point or something. Like you have to have at least 100 or 200 or whatever you need to
if you
make the game last a decent amount of time.
If you get 10 points and then you mass nuke your enemies to the point where they have nothing left, I win!
Well, to be fair, that you kind of have won if you do that, yeah. Though. Like, they're not going to stop you from walking into your city, so I mean, it's just a formality.
Does say in response, yes, like 70% of the points and at least 10 victory points. Once again, I think his absolute number of at least 10 points is a little on the low side, but yeah, something like that.
Yeah, especially economic, because every 10 gold in your income is worth one. Is that per turn?
Yes.
Yeah, so all you have to do is get 100 income, which seems really easy by mid-game, or 10 pop capital.
Well, you would need more than that, though, because they'd have some pop, so they would also be having some victory points.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess also what's kind of on my mind is if you can have as many coalitions you want, is that you're just going to have a bit of bloat, because endgame Civ can get sometimes a bit messy just in terms of how many things you have to organize. And if you have 9 coalitions you're part of, it's going to be a bit unwieldy.
I think there also needs to be diplomatic implications. If you try to get yourself into multiple economic coalitions and then you happen to decide, hey, I want to get into this defensive coalition or even to stay in a coalition or relationships otherwise with another nation, it could be fine if you want to try to balance all of these coalitions and keeping the members happy in order to get into and then stay in the coalition, then fine. You can go ahead and you can take that time. But yeah, you just don't want it to be, you know, if I'm in 2 economic coalitions, that's better than 1 because more is better. There needs to be some kind of limiter to getting in and then staying in as well.
Yeah, and if you do have that sort of thing, then you can go for economic warfare, where one economic coalition declares economic war on the other by basically saying we won't trade with that other coalition. And then if you are somebody that's in the middle of the two, you'll have to make a choice about which one to stick in or get kicked out of both. So there are probably ways to help weed out people who are trying to be in everything and make it easy.
And it also makes the game a little more fluid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in this economic coalition at turn 10, and then regardless of what I do or don't do afterwards, I'm still in it 100 turns later. Not necessarily what you do or don't do, and when you do something or don't do something, especially like when a vote comes up, you know, if something passes, but you're the only one that said no, and I'm not going to start talking about numbers or anything like that because that gets into more imbalance, but just as an idea, that the other nations, they remember that.
Yeah.
They take that into account.
It could be diplomacy or it could be vote-based. You have to stay diplomatically positive with all of the civs in the coalitions, else you might get kicked out.
That could actually work with victory points as well, is that your votes are based on your victory points, so if you just try to tag along and just not going to have any say at some point, so somebody else can just decide to kick you out because he contributes more points and has more votes.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't have good relations with that person,
yeah.
They can get other people to want to kick you out too.
Or if you are in multiple coalitions, maybe your victory points in the coalitions is divided by the number. I mean, maybe you're allowed two or three before that kicks in, but then after that.
Yeah, it depends on the type. Like, if you're trying to play off all the, say, economic-related ones, then yeah, your ability to influence all of them pretty much goes down to nothing. Whereas if you're the leader of one, then you'd have a lot more say. That would make sense. But yeah, I would say that only one defensive treaty type group at a time.
You can't be in both NATO and the Soviet bloc.
But you can probably still have these. You can have somebody in his coalition and then have a defensive pact with somebody else. And
yeah.
And you can still trigger weird coalitions going crazy at some point.
Yeah, or a war within a coalition because defensive pacts. half the people in the coalition are defending somebody else who's not part of the coalition yet.
And then that could result maybe in a coalition disintegrating and then breaking off into two,
yeah.
Where you have to kind of make a choice.
Yeah.
Are you trying to give the EU4 guys ideas?
Well, it's actually interesting you say that. I know EU4 was brought up earlier because in the thread, Cephalophobe talked about maybe allow smaller coalitions to be subsumed into larger ones or larger coalitions to split up or gain substructure, i.e. the Eurozone in the EU. I really like the idea of coalitions, but I think it'd be cool if they were more fluid towards the beginning. Yes, 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 yes. But then EU4 actually came up. General Just says, it really does sound like you should give Europa Universalis 4 a whirl. Because some people said, you are trying to make this to be more of a simulator than a 4X game. You should go play EU and keep this out of Civ. And I'm thinking, well, you don't just take what's in EU and go copy-paste. That doesn't mean that you can't have an idea of coalition.
And the coalition in this is nothing like coalitions in EU. The only association is the word itself.
And even that we'd rather
switch. Nothing to do with EU coalitions at all. Let's make that very clear.
Yeah. And even then, I would probably put it more like treaty organization or something like that.
Yeah.
Lock. Or give
well,
you a
it's closer
couple...
to what this proposal is. It's
yeah.
More so than a coalition, yes. It's more like a treaty organization. And but it's definitely not a proposal based on a concept from EU4. There's no.
No.
It is not.
And it is okay for strategy games to borrow concepts from each other's
absolutely.
Game, as long as it's not a direct copy and slapped into something like, if EU4 brought in Trade Route from Civ, that would be weird.
Yeah.
Because it just wouldn't work that way.
I think it would not work in the literal sense before we talk about anything else, but yes.
As a mechanic style.
Yeah.
In the thread, 19683DW says, for me, I'm trying to bring my people to dominance over every other culture in the world, either literally, scientifically, culturally, or diplomatically. The alternative of sharing success, like through a coalition, seems rather disappointing and wouldn't feel as significant. The coalition in real life still allow people to succeed independently, so that should be fine. It's kind of one of those things where, well, sure, if you're able to go it alone, then you could certainly make that choice. And by the way, there's nothing to say, I am going to be in this coalition to prop myself up, and then at a certain point, I am then going to leave, and then for that last push, win it alone. Someone also made the suggestion, they said, this sounds kind of odd in single player. Why would you want to share a victory with an AI? It makes it more hollow. It doesn't seem real. It's not as cut and dry.
What?
And okay, now we're getting into a personal preference sort of thing. But it's not a permanent alliance.
No.
It's not like you've locked yourself in from now until the end of the game. So I'm glad we use the term like coalition and not an alliance, even though strictly speaking there's not one example of coalition or one example of alliance. But given that we've already used the term alliance in the Civilization series, I like how this is different. Like we were saying, even though the suggestion said not be a member of more than one coalition, and I assume he meant not more than one member of one coalition at a time. So I think even in his suggestion, you could be in coalition A and then go to coalition B, have different types of coalitions, and maybe you're in some, or heck, maybe you're in none of them at all. Just like, I mean, I don't know why you would do this, but you can kind of pretty well ignore religion entirely, for example, in Civilization V. Now, when I say entirely, it is probably the likelihood that someone's religion is going to spread to you eventually, but you don't have to engage in it, just like you wouldn't have to engage in a coalition, and maybe sometimes that's an advantage. It shouldn't always be you must absolutely join a coalition every game.
But I would just assume that if you're in a coalition with others, then your tourism and other stuff will spread to them better than if you weren't, so...
I would like to see some disincentive to being a tool bag and just leaving the coalition and blowing up your former allies, though.
Yeah.
I feel like if you want to solo everybody, you should either just not join the coalition in the first place, or you have some penalty or disincentive to just turning on your allies. Not that you like can't do it, you absolutely should be able to do it for fun, but there should not be incentive to give up on a shared victory just to screw your partners, basically.
I suppose that's with a shared with a victory points anyway, because if it breaks up, how are the victory points going to be shared? Probably going to be split up between everybody who was in a coalition before. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Because you can't have everybody keep for victory points when they leave.
Yes, or all those victory points get thrown out. If, say, somebody blows up the coalition, coalition-based victory points just get thrown out the window. Doesn't exist anymore. Therefore, it's not providing victory. So you can have a, say, medieval-era coalition that did a bunch of stuff, but it stopped being useful, so it got thrown out. So why would it be influential to the end of the game when it doesn't exist anymore?
And that actually goes to the sentiment in the thread, which was, this sounds like the game's going to end too early. Oh, well, I think our coalition's going to win here on turn 50. No, we can't have that. I'm going to break it up, and then the game can go longer. You're welcome. Jeez.
I don't think it would be problematic to tune a game such that that wouldn't happen, especially if you're building Civ 6 with this kind of thing in mind.
Yeah, you'd probably say something like coalition victory can't exist until after the modern era.
Unless you just conquer everyone else.
Well, if everybody's dead...
That should always
dead.
Be in play.
Yeah.
That's always an option.
Except yourself, of course.
Yeah. I'm fine with the sort of concept of all the city-states will band together into a treaty organization that could become sort of a world congressy thing, and then the major civs would have to, like, convince the city-states to let them in.
And that would be
a conquest victory.
I was going to say, city-states all join a coalition together, and they say, hey, there's this guy that keeps bullying us. Can you do something about it? If you do, we'll join your coalition if you declare war on them.
Yeah.
And then because we're playing a co-op game, I'm not actually going to attack him, but I'll declare war on him.
But it would make sense.
It would.
Even city-states, like all the city-states around Civ X join a coalition against them, or join a treaty around them, and then, well, they might all individually be pretty useless when they're together.
Well, if it's all the ones on Dan's continent, he's probably going to go, oh, that's cute, and squish them all.
Or they'll squish
him
back.
Not denying it.
Or they'll squish him back.
That's why if the city-states could band together and then get another civilization to declare war and then actually do something about it, and not just say, okay, we'll air quotes declare war, but it ends up being a cold war. You know, they don't actually do anything in terms of taking land or anything like that. But if there could be an actual effect of, you know, if I bully states these cities too much, not only are they going to gang up on me, but they're going to get themselves an ally and they're going to come rolling in, it'd make you think twice.
Yeah.
We've gone from the original suggestion, talking about the specifics, the values of it, why that's good or bad, and then talking about it in more general terms, and now talking about stuff that actually didn't even come up in the thread, other than someone mentioned city-states, and the person who started this thread went, oh, I just get rid of city-states anyway, I don't like that mechanic. Well, you know, I mean, that's one choice, I suppose, but it doesn't preclude the fact city-states being in a Civilization VI with this.
Yeah, and actually city-states would work with this little treaty organization coalition thing better than... some of the other stuff, because then you have small people getting together to go after the big guys rather than all the big guys getting together.
Yeah, 19683DW did say, I like the current setup of solid goals where victories aren't shared and small, weaker nations can still win single-handedly by surprise.
No.
Well,
no. If you're small and you're weak, you should lose.
What would make more sense, actually, is if you were a smaller, weaker nation and ended up being the quote-unquote weakest link in a larger or a decent coalition, seeing as how it would be a shared victory, potentially regardless of what you do or don't do or when you do it or don't do it, you could still win because it would be a shared victory. You would still have to contribute in some way in order to stay in that coalition. But that would actually be a way to say, ah, the smaller, weaker nation, man, they played their diplomatic cards well. They weren't the strongest militaristically, but they really had a powerful economy, so they used that to help their fellow coalition members and stay in there, rather than, how the heck did you just pull off a diplomatic victory? You're nothing. Oh, wait, you went and got all those city-state allies in the last few turns, you bugger.
Apostolic palace. Oh.
Oh, geez, no. No, Phil.
Yeah, obviously they have to prevent abuse.
19683DW's implication that if you put this in the system, okay, they couldn't win single-handedly, but they could actually still win.
Yeah.
And if you saw that a smaller, weaker nation was part of a larger coalition, they didn't just win by themselves. You could say, no, that was smart. I wish I'd thought of that because I was ahead of them, but I didn't play my cards as well. And so then they ended up being on the winning team as opposed to the victor outright, which would then be, what are you talking about?
And what's wrong with a shared victory by a small nation? They'll get a bad score or whatever, but man, there's nothing wrong with that conceptually. Well,
if a bunch of small nations got together and had a shared victory, then that'd be okay. But
that'd be even more impressive.
But the super small nation that never really did anything, mechanics shouldn't allow. Just in
general.
Well,
okay, I mean, you can quote-unquote win a game like that, but what meaning does that have, really?
Yeah.
I don't see why that matters. If you get your jollies by quote-unquote winning while sitting there as an OPM and then joining into a coalition and that and, like, just, you know, happening to be on the winning side, I mean, I guess. What's wrong with that? If you find that enjoyable, go ahead, win.
Yeah, I just don't want it to be a path to, this is how I won, and then have like a billion, I beat Deity because I joined a coalition at the last minute.
From another angle, I think this also can help with the, guess what, there's that runaway AI, especially on that other continent. Well, I guess they're going to steamroll the victory because they're that much farther ahead in this, that, and the other thing. But once the other nations of the world know that you exist, for instance, which kind of ties back to at a certain point, you can then have coalitions. It's not just from the very beginning. It's, say, see that guy over there? He's got science, land, production, military. But guess what? If we compile all of our resources together, then we as a coalition can be just as, if not more powerful than that person. And now maybe we're not going to be so inclined to rage quit.
I don't think you'll ever stop rage quit.
No, but I think it's one of those, what am I supposed to do now? They went and conquered their continent before I ever met them. Look how much farther ahead they are. What the heck am I supposed to do now? And this also ties into victory. Okay, I guess I'm not going to go down that victory path. I'm going to go and switch to a different kind. And we know that, for example, with the culture of victory, with subsequent expansion packs, that it's easier to change midstream what you're doing without reloading old saves. Ho, ho, ho. But at the same time, it also gives you another path and another choice that is practical within game and makes sense within the mechanics, which is, okay, maybe you're going to have to play a little bit more diplomatic game. Maybe you're going to have to bide your time a little bit here. But it's not, I'm screwed. And from the other side, well, I completely conquered my continent. I haven't met anybody else. It's turn 50 or 60. I'm just going to steamroll to victory now. It's just a matter of rolling over the turns. Nope, not necessarily. You could find a whole bunch of other people that decide they want to get rid of you. And then what they do after they get rid of you, maybe their coalition breaks up now that you're destroyed. But then, hey, that's their problem.
I would really like that.
I would say you have to change the AI to realize global threats versus local, because otherwise they would also go, well, maybe my fastest way to dealing with that person over there is to just kill you rather than playing nice with you. And then you have the same old problem.
Yeah, but if it was changed like that, that would actually be a really nice catch-up mechanic, because that's one thing about civilization, that sometimes you just get to a point where you can't win, or you always win, and it's nice to just have a catch-up mechanic that's just not so artificial by boosting the lower scores or putting in inflation or something to punish what's ahead, but actually make it like really a gameplay mechanic.
Getting to what I was getting at as well, which is,
yeah,
there's not this either lull or this, well, it's all but a guarantee unless somebody does something stupid or something does something extraordinary. There's this mechanic that comes in that can help level the playing field. It's not like starting at turn zero again. It's not like you reset everything, but it's just a shift in terms of your thinking, in terms of diplomacy, production, science, land, military, culture, all of these aspects that also speak to the victory conditions, or in this case, victory points, where the points are the condition.
I just like that it feels more natural than having a sort of rule that just says, oh yeah, you can't do that anymore. We just give technologies to somebody so they catch up, especially with lower AIs.
I don't know what else there is to say other than let's get a prototype of this done. We'll talk on the next episode. We'll test it.
Oh, yeah. We have spent a lot of time on that topic, and it's something at least in concept that we all seem to like, which is not always the case with research lab topics.
Hey, guess what? We're going to talk about a suggestion, and we're going to talk about how we like it more than not. That's not interesting. You guys hate everything.
Yeah.
Aww.
Not true. We just hate that you think that. Wait, no. What?
Exactly.
Honorable mention from episode 233.
Any of you guys have mentioned the best feature from a previous Civ game, which was, of course, upgrading the throne room.
Oh,
yeah. Nice. I always just disabled that because I'm an annoying person, fuddy-duddy, screw the throne room.
I liked it, but...
But yeah, I wouldn't mind having an option to disable it and then let other people enjoy it. It's fine.
Well, it might be nice if it actually had some kind of gameplay value. I can't say how it would, but, you know,
plus food everywhere because I put this plant in my throne room.
Yeah.
1% food globally.
Yeah, it's all diplomacy level. Hey, your throne room is ugly. I don't like you.
No, right, you got a penalty for people who pick differently and a bonus of the people who pick the same stuff.
You like that kind of music? We are hatred enemies.
That yep. rug is terrible.
What does the fox say? That you're getting nuked. That's what the fox says. Okay, I changed my mind. This would be awesome.
Yes.
Gal goes nuke.
And number one from episode 231.
Got your Montes, your Alexes, your Shakas. Like,
yeah,
those are the people I want in the world. So if I see some jerkwad like Sejong or something, he needs to go. We need to get rid of these peacenik garbage civs and just make the world a proper place to live.
The Huns or Assyria? In terms of wiping them out, in terms of being target number one, especially the Huns, and maybe less so Assyria because that advantage with the siege tower, but quite honestly, if you can just keep them at bay in the early game, they lose their teeth.
Particularly Attila.
Yeah, but Shaka? Oh.
They have fun promotions for a very long time, and the imp comes in right at a critical point.
And there's so many of them.
I'm glad you understand now, Dan, that Civ just didn't Civ without Shaka in it. He was a necessary and great component for Civ 5. See, I called it. They needed Shaka. They needed the Zulu.
Call it today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series official website at
thepolycast.net.
Thank you for tuning in to Polycast Evergreen, Season 9. I'm Mauta Lacuta Snyders. Attain perfection.
Civilization 1 Clips, copyright MicroProse.
Civilization 4 Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.